Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Picks with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen. And just like that, we're back. We're getting set for UFC Fight Night, Vera versus Sandhagen. As always, one half of your host, Noah Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen, FNP, and I know we're really excited for the card that's coming up this weekend. Marlon Vera, ranked third in the bantamweight division. He's rung off four straight wins, finished the bantamweight goat his last time out, fourth round, head kick knockout. It wasn't Leon Edwards-esque, but it was a big-time win over Dominic Cruz back last year. And for Corey Sandhagen, the same thing can be said, a fourth round finish, doctor stoppage, the cuts to poor Song Yadong's face in that fight. Sandhagen gets the win. So a couple of guys looking to get into the mix at the top of the bantamweight division. You look at this card in general, this is the first time the UFC's gone back to the Alamo City of San Antonio since 2019. It was a Fight Night main event that featured, well, the aforementioned Leon Rocky Edwards getting the win over Rafael Dos Anjos. Really set him up well for the man that he is now, coming off that big-time title win over the weekend.
I hope you're as happy as I am. And I know Dana White said, like, hey, we're getting too comfortable at the Apex. Get these shows on the road. I'm loving these Fight Nights in pack crowds.
Yeah, and I mean, the UK crowd, they seemed a little down. They were a little quiet. Bring it back to the Canada. Matt, when we do look at this card, you have two, this is going to sound crazy, former UFC featherweight title challengers in the co-main event. Oh, yeah. Holly Holm, the former bantamweight champ, taking on Yana. It's now Santos, not Kuniskaya. She's making a return after almost 2 years away. We look through this again. 13 total fights, a couple of debuts here and there, a couple of reshuffled fighters to look forward to in Haley Cowan-Brennan, as well as Venetia Salvador. Second time's out for Tamiris Vidal, Manuel Torres, and Lucas Alexander. Matt, this isn't one of those cards that's going to be full of stars, but again, it's one of those ones that feels like a Fight Night Pick special.
It's also the easiest main event anybody could ever get up for. And I know the bantamweight division's in a weird logjam right now. You've got Merab, Sean O'Malley, Aljamain, Henry Cejudo. Like, there's so many kind of top contenders and justified number one contenders in the division that I don't know what the winner of this is going to get, to be completely honest with you. But it's going to be an amazing fight because Marlon Vera and Corey Sandhagen are very similar fighters. And I mean that in the best way possible. These are two guys who are willing to eat a shot to give their own. They have incredible striking repertoires. And I think that fight's going to deliver and really become one of those fight of the year style fights, because we get five incredible rounds of this. I know we were both really excited about Fazeev and Gaethje last week, and that was a great fight, don't get me wrong, but we only got three rounds of that one, so I'm just incredibly happy that we finally get five rounds for this one.
Matt, letting the cat out of the bag, we have a Fight of the Night screen, and as we always do week in and week out, we throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And as we said, you want to talk about a Fight of the Night, the main event, Marlon Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen. This is a big-time matchup in this bantamweight division, and Merab Dvalishvili is a little bit like that beaver that you blow up the dam, you take a shovel to the dam, and he just comes back and he builds it back up. He wants to log jam that division. It seems like Aljamain Sterling, after his fight with Cejudo, the rumblings about him moving up to featherweight and challenging Volkanovski, all of a sudden Islam Makhachev calling for a shot against Leon Edwards. Divisions are just kind of stuck in that position. But when you do look overall at this fight, Marlon Vera against Corey Sandhagen, a couple of guys that'll switch stance in the middle of the fight. They'll throw a couple of leg kicks. They'll get in and out of the pocket, but they will absorb one to give their own. This should be a big-time fight. When you consider it, everybody, so it seems, is booked up at the top of the division. Piotr Jan now kind of falling out of favor. Sean O'Malley waiting his turn patiently. You look at this fight, there still is title implications on this one.
And that's the thing. As a fan of MMA, that's when you know a division is in a great spot. When you have five, six, seven guys that you honestly believe could be good enough to win the title. Now, it would probably suck to be one of those six or seven guys in the division, because like you said, it is very logjammed at the top, but this is one of those fights where Corey Sandhagen could fight anybody in the division. You're going to get excited for it. Marlon Vera, same thing. The fact that this is the matchup is what makes this fight so incredible. I'm glad that we are getting these guys in kind of these primary striking battles for a number one contender fight, instead of just doing like Merab versus Corey Sandhagen, because it would be a great fight. It's a fight a lot of people can get excited excited for, but stylistically, it might not make for the most exciting one by the time it's over.
So you picked the second one, Matt, and this one might jump off the page for some people as to why. I mean, hold on. But Nate the Train Landwehr, on short notice, he was supposed to be taking on Alex Caceres. Austin Lingo was supposed to fight a couple of weeks ago. That fight fell out, so ultimately we get Lingo versus Landwehr. Lingo's been on the shelf, but if you've ever seen an Austin Lingo fight, he fights up to his nickname, Lights Out. He goes out there and throws down. And when you look at it for Nate the Train, he's had Fight of the Night caliber fights in the UFC. His last time out was that tricky majority decision win over David Onama. You're beating guys like David Onama and coming back and having bloodbath style fights, and then you're gonna fight Austin Lingo. That screams Fight of the Night on paper.
Nate Landwehr doesn't know how not to be exciting. He is like, he's like the bus from that movie Speed. He's just going forward, and if he stops, you're worried he might blow up because it's so out of character for him. I love watching Nate Landwehr fight because it might not be a style that gets him to the top of the division, that wins multiple titles, but it's a style that, like you said, is going to get him into a lot of these Fight of the Nights, and I'll be curious to see how Austin Lingo deals with this kind of a matchup because, like you said, been away for a little while, and Nate Landwehr is the type of guy who's going to be in his face and not really give him a lot of opportunities to breathe, so I think this could be an incredible fight.
13 total fights, you're not wrong, until Saturday night. Toss us that pick for the Fight of the Night on the Fight of the Night screen. So UFC rookie debuts from Hayley Cowan-Brennan. She was supposed to take on Eileen Perez a few weeks ago. Now she gets to take on a former Eileen Perez foe in Tamiris Vidal, who's taking this fight on somewhat of short notice. You also had the aforementioned Venetia Salvador. He was supposed to take on Daniel Da Silva, that's also on this card. It's got to be super awkward for Venetia Salvador, who's taking on Victor Altamirano and Daniel Da Silva. Some bad blood amongst them. We look at it again, second time's out for three different fighters. There's a lot of fighters with less than three fights experience in the UFC. I'm thinking Preston Parsons, Damn Daniel, who's lost three fights by finish.
But like, I think you'd agree with me. There are a lot of names on this card that they might not be big names that really put butts in seats, but they're exciting fighters for sure.
Marlon Vera, Corey Sandhagen, in the top five. Then you have Holly Holm and Yana Santos, who's making the comeback. You also have ranked fighters in Andrea Lee taking on Macy Barber. And then in the flyweight division, Alex Perez, who's coming off that title fight against Deiveson Figueiredo. Then the first round quick loss to Alessandro Pantoja. Now he's taking on the man representing Angola and Portugal, Immanuel Kopp, who's just been on an absolute tear. So when you look at this card overall, I mean, some others that have had some good success. Daniel Pineda over with the PFL.
Like Steven Peterson, Daniel Pineda, Chidian Chukwuani, Immanuel Kopp, Macy Barber to a certain degree, Nate Landwehr, of course. Like, these are people who are never really in boring fights. So there's a lot of matchups on this card you can easily get excited for.
Matt, some big time matchups coming up this weekend. 2 hours before the prelims, we're live for Question Mark Kicks here on the channel. Doubt it's going to be as early as it was last weekend, because that fight card was over in England. This one's in Texas. So a lot to look forward to. You can find us if there's any switch ups of the matchups here on YouTube. So make sure you toss that subscribe. It is much appreciated. It's a big-time fight card coming up this weekend. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Bantamweights looking to make a mark in a wide-open division. Coming up this weekend, we have Waco, Texas' own Hayley Cowan-Brennan taking on the Brazilian sensational woman who hasn't lost a fight since 2019. I'm talking about Tratora, or as the UFC's just going to anglicize it as Tractor, Tamiris Vidal. Matt, Tamiris Vidal came in, took on Ramona Pascual in her UFC debut, picked up a performance of the night bonus in that one, landing that jumping switch knee to the body, finishing Ramona Pascual. So this fight was announced back on March 10th by Nolan Kings of MMA Junkie that Vidal would be taking or accepting the fight against Cowan, because for Hayley Cowan-Brennan, something I've never heard of before, but I can probably hear my wife wincing in pain outside of this room, is the fact that Cowan-Brennan, the day before the fight after weigh-ins, had to be forced out of it because of an ovarian cyst rupture, and that just sounds awfully painful for somebody who doesn't have those things. But when you look at this matchup, Matt, we talked a lot about Hayley Cowan-Brennan going into that fight against Eileen Perez, because for Perez, she fought Tamiris Vidal. She lost to Tamiris Vidal, and that's that not the no contest. That was a loss due to disqualification on the record. Throw it on back to that fight that Hayley Cowan-Brennan was supposed to have in the debut. And you know Cowan-Brennan from the fact that Division I All-American, two times over, 2012, 2013. Matt, what was that in?
Acrobatics and tumbling. So we've had different backgrounds coming into the UFC. I was thinking, okay.
Sam Hughes, famously with track and field.
You've got Courtney Casey with soccer, but Kenny Florian had a soccer background too, so a couple of soccer backgrounds. But for Haley Cowan, you look at it, you look at her overall fighting style, she is kind of a tricky striker from the outside. She's got a really wide base. She really likes to throw hooks in there, but she very much is a strike to clinch, clinch to takedown, takedown to top pressure, stack guard down, and try and land some ground.
And it does kind of require that level of progress to get from one stage to the other. And that's the thing about Cowan Brennan that I do worry about when she does face upper echelon fighters, because that's the thing, and I've got to say this right now. The winner of this isn't going to then prove to us, wow, I'm ready for a ranked opponent, and I might fight Valentina Shevchenko one day.
You fight Chelsea Chandler next.
Yeah, that's a pretty good matchup, honestly. And then we learn a lot more about you after that. I think Cowan Brennan can get a lot of top pressure, can be very dominant with her wrestling. I'm not sure if she does necessarily have the high-level submission abilities that you need to go out there and get a submission win. Again, she is, like you mentioned, more of a wrestler than a submission artist. Now, she can soften her opponent up with good ground and pound and then open up a submission. But again, Cowan's not a fighter like Tatiana Suarez, who we're going to talk about a little bit later, who's going to go out there, really make you feel her presence, and then try to open up the submissions from that. I do think Cowan is the much more well-rounded fighter, though, and when these two fighters, and I hate to describe it like this, but when you have two lower-level fighters, the one who is more well-rounded more likely is the one to win, because again, if she's able to keep it on the feet, I don't think Cowan Brennan is going to get knocked out 5 seconds into this fight. I do think the clinch is going to be oddly important, and that's what I hope for. Hopefully we get an offensive clinch out of both these fighters, because if we just get a lot of clinch control from Cowan up against the cage, this is going to become a very stale fight very quickly.
Depends on what referee it is, because if it's Herb Dean, he's going to do the old work. But if it's Mark Smith, like, he'll just let them play on. If it's Jacob Montalvo, you clinch, you have fun, enjoy it. Chris Tione, hey, have fun in that clinch. But when I look through this and I look at Haley Cowan, and again, we have Cowan Brennan on screen because she married Nick Brennan, who is also another member at Blitz Sport. He's a coach there. He had an MMA career as a pro. So just trying to give her the credit that she has on her Instagram. So when you look at it and you consider a fight that she had against Claudia Leitchi over on Dana White's Contender Series, I actually picked Leitchi to win the fight. That was my one pick of the episode, because that's how our Dana White's Contender Series episode picks went, I guess. And out of that one, Cowan wins by split decision. She loses like the first, but then she wins the second, she wins the third, she wins the first and maybe the third. Like, it was kind of weird. Leitchi won the second round, but out of it, Dana White said, "I think Haley is a solid athlete, and I can't put my finger on it, but I like everything about her. I'm going to give her a shot." Dana White really just putting all his chips in there. What do you make of that?
You don't hear NBA general managers talk like that. But they normally use stats and science to back it up.
It was neat how Cowan described her kind of foray and interest in MMA. She did an article with Flow Combat, Hunter Homestick. You don't hear his name as much anymore in MMA. And it was in 2006, I watched Matt Hughes versus George St. Pierre with my dad, and I told my dad I wanted to be GSP, but the girl version. So, hey, good for Haley Cowan pulling together a 7-2 pro record. So in the matchup that Haley Cowan was supposed to have against Eileen Perez, I mean, you would pick Cowan, I pick Perez, but ultimately we said, okay, they're both net negative strikers.
Yes.
And I would say that same thing in this matchup.
For sure.
Even though Tamir Spidal won by a performance of the night, jumping switch knee to the body. Do you still agree with that one?
I think Vidal's the better striker in this matchup because of her physicality, but I don't think she's going to go out there and out-technique a lot of these fighters in the top of the division. I do think Cowan is going to struggle a lot with the physicality of Vidal, and that's what I keep on going back to in this matchup.
Which is weird because Perez didn't struggle at all.
No, I understand. But I do think this is something Cowan's going to struggle with. Cowan reminds me a little bit of a fighter that we saw last week on the pay-per-view and Sam Patterson, just in the way that she does hold herself very upright. I think it could open up some of those bigger strikes for Vidal. Now, I don't think we are going to see Vidal go out there and get a ton of these first-round knockouts or second-round knockouts, but I have been concerned about Cowan's striking defense and her posture, especially moving backwards. I just think a striker who goes out there and throws a lot of wild shots and gives themselves opportunity to land that are going to have that chance against Cowan, but I still think their grappling is going to be at the forefront of both these fighters.
Yeah, and you look at it for Tamir Spidal, you go up and down through the record, and as I said, she hasn't lost since 2019. That was a fight against Carol Hosa when Vidal was 1-0.
Carol Hossa was 9-3. Hossa wins that fight, then wins one more, and then she's in the UFC. So for Vidal, it was a little bit too much too soon, but you go up and down through the record. She does have a squeaky, tidy...
She was young back then, too. Like, yeah, she's still young now.
She does have a win over Martina Jindrova, who then went on to fight Kayla Harrison with PFL. She beat Eileen Perez. Again, she was losing that fight mightily, and I went back and watched that, and we showed the picture before, and I'll show it again. She fights on a gym floor that's foam mats, and in that one, Perez is all over it. But if you look at the first round, Perez initiates the clinch. Vidal tries to get into position. Perez throws kind of like a hip toss. She gets on top, and then she punches to the back of the head. She then lands a knee below the belt. The referee kind of gives her more, or warns her there. Then in round number two, more knees, more Perez top control. And in the third round, it was Perez getting it down to the mat again. Vidal's up against the side, an illegal knee to the head by Perez. She lands two of them, and then she complains again, but she's eventually disqualified out of that matchup. You look at Tamiris Vidal's fight against Kayla Braga over with the LFA, LFA 126, and there were a lot of similarities in the Perez fight and the Braga fight to where Braga was a boxer, Braga was going out there having success with the striking, but for Vidal, you saw it, she was going for heel hook after heel hook after heel hook, really, which is what she was trying against Perez. Perez was hip to it. Perez would get out of all of those positions. Against Braga, not so much so. And in the second round, wearing her down, going out there, getting the submission victory was Tamiris Vidal. So if you do really consider it and you go through these matchups, like you said, you don't see Vidal going out there and getting a knockout. That was her first knockout win against Ramona Pascual.
It was a great one, though. That's the thing.
Vidal's striking is incredibly basic on the feet. It's a lot of holding your head up, hands down, jab, jab, trying to land a looping right hand. When you try and focus on a ceiling, which you try and do on the channel, I don't see the ceiling being very high for necessarily either fighter in the matchup. And for Tamiris Vidal, it was incredibly impressive for her to get that win because I didn't necessarily see her getting it in that fashion against somebody like Ramona Pascual. So we have a look at this matchup, Matt. We have a look at the odds. Tamiris Vidal, it feels, again, a little bit like a Juliana Miller. Oh, so you got to win in the UFC? Now you're a juiced up favorite. Vidal is more than a 2-1 favorite in the matchup. Haley Cowan was favored ever so slightly to beat Eileen Perez in that supposed UFC debut or the expected UFC debut. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. If Vidal's that big of a favorite, I'm assuming the fans are going to go with her.
Probably.
I'm going to say over under 72.5% Vidal.
I personally have it under, but I think the fans will have it over.
They do have it over. 420 Blaze votes, 85% Vidal, 50% by decision, 33% by submission. For the 15% that have Cowan Brennan, 66% by decision. Who do you have in the matchup?
It's a weird fight, but I do think cardio and lasting power is going to be very important in it. Because if Vidal does find herself fishing for a lot of those submissions, like you had mentioned, and not really being able to secure top position with those, because that's going to be the big thing in this fight, I'm not sure if we are going to get a finish either way. I know the odds kind of suggest that, hey, Vidal might go out there and get a finish because she is a decent favorite, but I just see a lot of grappling between these two. I don't think Cowan has those deficiencies in her game to where, hey, she's going to get tangled up with the legs, make some of those mistakes, kind of like Muhammad Makhachev did. That's a guy who's not going to be walking all that great this week, but I do ever so slightly have Vidal. I do think her ability to use the legs, because this is the thing that we didn't see a lot in the fight with Marin Vettori versus Roman Dolidze, but it's something Roman does quite well. He does like to threaten with a lot of those leg locks to then initiate scrambles on the mat to then get on top. Now, I know I'm projecting a lot of what Vidal could do, but for those reasons, I do ever so slightly have her in the matchup. But like you had said, I don't know why the odds are where they are.
You said you like the cardio, but Tamiris Vidal doesn't tend to have great cardio.
It could very much be or come down to that.
Tamiris Vidal in the matchup based on the fact that I think that her jiu-jitsu is a little bit better. It's a little bit more advanced. I think she can have a little bit more success in the grappling. Haley Cowan is a good wrestler. She can throw better volume, in my opinion, than somebody like Tamiris Vidal. If you like an underdog pick and an unranked fighter that's on this card, Haley Cowan Brennan might be that fighter. For both of us, we're going with Brazil's Tamiris Vidal. Feels like a trap card type of fight. 13 total matchups on the card. Marlon Chito Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of lightweights looking to earn their respective second wins inside of the UFC's octagon. We have Mexico's El Loco, Manuel Torres, and yes, he turns exactly 28 on March 25th, which is fight day, taking on the Samurai Ghost, Trey Ogden. Matt, when you look at this matchup right here,
I'd say oil and water when it comes to a couple of different fighters. I mean, for both of these guys, they primarily do get it done by finish. For Manuel Torres, equal amount of wins by knockout and by submission. For Trey Ogden, 11 of his 16 big wins are by submission. Now, inside of the UFC, he has that weird close loss to Jordan Leavitt where a lot of people thought that Ogden was
actually a great account of himself.
The winner in that debut. His last time out against Daniel Zellhuber hit as a big-time underdog. He was a plus 320 against Zellhuber. And I remember in that video, I'm taking Zellhuber, but there were a lot of red flags. And Trey Ogden is one of those guys that if you don't have the fundamentals to your game,
exactly,
Trey Ogden will exploit those weaknesses. And we saw that in the fight against JJ Okanovich over on Dana White's Looking for a Fight. That was a Fury FC fight. And Ogden was able to go out there, withstand the early storm of the takedown attempts, submission attempts from Okanovich. And then he went out there and put it on in his own right. And that was a fight where it started me going, hey, Dana, oh, I don't like to sign guys that are about 32 years old, but I really did like what I saw out of you, kid. So for Trey Ogden, great performance.
That's the thing about Trey Ogden. Even though grappling is at the forefront of his game, guys who are better than him at wrestling, better than him at jiu-jitsu, will have some success against him on the mat. But what I love about Trey Ogden is it reminds me of what every middle school coach tells every basketball player. It's, hey, if you don't have the ball, keep moving. Like, don't give up on the play. Keep on moving. Trey Ogden keeps on moving and doesn't give up on the play.
Trey Ogden was a guy that didn't hot dog it when ground balls were getting hit.
Exactly.
He was going right down in front of that ball.
Yeah, like, he was going as hard in practice as he was in the game because, hey, that gets you ready for the game. But that's what I like about Ogden. Even when he's in bad positions, he keeps working. And a lot of the times, he will scramble into that top position.
And that's a testament to his life, brother, because if you look at it for Trey Ogden, he continues to be the owner of Glory MMA and Fitness Overland Park, which quickly rebranded in December to Momentum MMA. So Trey Ogden fighting out of Momentum MMA there. But just a crazy kind of life story, because what does he do in his personal life? He's a personal trainer, a jiu-jitsu and MMA coach, and he owns his own gym. And that just kind of speaks to the way that he fights and the way that he attacks life as well.
100%. But he does have a very good fundamental skill set, and that's why he's a great opponent for really any prospect on the rise. We talked about Malcolm Gordon's an opponent kind of like this. We saw him last weekend. The week before that, Tony Gravely, he's another guy. Like, there's some opponents in every single weight class that you just want prospects to fight on their way up because you know what they're good at, you know what they're not great at. And in this matchup, it will be really interesting to see how comfortable Manuel Torres is with range, because I don't think he's going to be able to blast a ton of kicks in this fight, because if he does, that's how Trey Ogden is going to end up on top. And the thing about Torres's game is when he does end up throwing a lot of his combinations, he will burn very hot. And if we do see him have a lot of success, especially really early against a guy like Ogden, this could be one of those trapdoor fights where everything's going right for Torres, he's looking really good, and then all of a sudden in the second round, he throws a combination, takes a step back, and he's breathing a little heavily. And then he can't defend the takedown as well. Then we might see him give up the takedown. I just think this is a really interesting fight because it can go so many different ways. Because again, you have to give Ogden the respect he deserves as a good opponent.
So for the birthday boy, Manuel Torres, fights out of Entram Gym. I mean, you see Johnny Munoz Jr. over there in the camp. You also see a guy, and I never thought I'd say it, Jesus Aguilar, big time winner in the UFC, and Yasmin Jauregui as well. But so many great training partners at Entram Gym. They've really leveled up of late. But when you look at it for Torres, 13 total wins, 12 of them in the first friggin' round, one by split decision. And when I watch Manuel Torres, I think the nervous energy helps him out a little bit in some of these fights, because you talk about a guy that burns hot. His fight against, it's not the Canada, it's Kanyada. We talked about it last weekend, Yanal Ashmoz, and I threw the picture up where he's guillotining a guy and picking him up
sure
in the air. Manuel Torres runs across the cage throwing strikes, picks up Kanyada. You see every single muscle fiber in his back, and then he sets him down gracefully in a crumpled position because he guillotined him and got the finish win. For Torres, in his UFC debut, picks up the first round KO win over Frank Camacho. Performance bonus winner was that finish. And it's crazy because he lands the left hook, the right hook, drops him like a sack of potatoes. Torres wins that fight back in May of last year. I'm surprised that we haven't seen him compete sooner.
So am I.
Because when you pick up a win like that over an established UFC veteran, you'd think only good things are to come. So it's a little weird there.
I think we have to agree on this much, though. Trey Ogden is so much more durable at this stage of his career than Frank Camacho was when he fought Manuel Torres. Like, I know Frank Camacho looks like a good name to have on your resume, but you kind of have to look at where he was at his career at that point.
And you got to go back and watch the fight, not the result, because in that one,
Camacho was landing big on Manuel Torres, but what I know out of Torres is he can hit hard, he can get hit hard, and he can get out of some of those bad positions.
And that's the really frustrating thing about watching him. When he does use his range, his kicks, and his straight shots, he is hard to hit, and he does have incredible power. The problem is he will collapse his own range sometimes, and it makes him much more hittable. Yes, it will accentuate his power, get some of his hooks in there too, but the problem is Trey Ogden might not be the guy who's going to go in there, really make him pay for it outside of the takedowns and just being gritty and maybe making him tired with this striking defense, but Ogden might have the avenue to land some of his own strikes and some of the in-between.
So we have a look at the odds, Matt. Manuel Torres, pretty big favorite in the fight. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there. To you, I'm going to say over under 82.5% Manuel Torres.
I think they'll be over.
Think they're going to be over? Oh boy. 473 total votes, 82% Torres, 70% by knockout for the 18% that have Ogden, 51% by decision, 30% by submission. I think Trey Ogden completely outlasts Manuel Torres. I think he makes the fight a little bit slower, and he goes out there and beats the guy that fights in 1.5 speed. The guy that's the former beatdown and triple R featherweight champ, and he was partway through his law degree coming in the UFC. Maybe that's why Manuel Torres.
Smart guy.
Yeah, maybe that's why we haven't seen him fight all that often, focusing on his skewling. But for me, I do like Trey Ogden in the fight. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, black belt, we've seen him beat. It's not just that he beat Daniel Zellhuber, another top prospect out of Latin America. But for me, for Manuel Torres, he just does things way too quick. And I think Ogden can grind on him and pick up the win in this matchup.
I agree with everything you said. I just think Torres is going to make him pay for it a lot before he's able to grind up on him and make him pay for some of those exchanges later on in the fight. So I do like Torres for those first two rounds. So I really am banking on him for those, because if it does make it to a third round, and if Torres is fighting in that aggressive style that he normally does, and I don't think he's going to revert back into like a defensive Brad Pickett type of a striker, weird name to bring up, but I do think Ogden is the more favorable guy, especially as this fight goes late, but I like Torres early, and for that reason I do have Torres.
If it goes late and it goes to a decision, I'm gonna get it wrong regardless, because that's what happens on these cards. But Matt, we're split on the pick. You're going with Emmanuel Torres, the birthday boy. I'm going with the Samurai Ghost. Don't love the nickname.
It's too edgy.
Trey Ogden, big time matchup coming up this weekend, and in the main event, Marlon Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen. You're not gonna want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We all always say, let's get into it. Flyweight just keeps adding talent. Both guys coming off of Dana White Contender Series wins. We have El Magnifico, Victor Altamirano, coming off his first UFC win in a barn burner of a first round against Daniel Da Silva. He's going to be taking on Fenomeno Vinicius Salvador. And when you look at this matchup, Matt, I mean, Daniel Da Silva, for some reason, he's fought three times in the UFC. He's lost every fight by finish, and he's fighting higher up on the card against, a good fighter in CJ Vergara. I don't understand it, but when I look at this fight, Matt, Altamirano goes out there. He gets dropped in the first minute and a half. He comes back. He lands a hook to the body, a knee to the body that drops damn Daniel. Hits him with a lot of elbows and strikes from the guard. And then he pops up stat guard like it's 2010, and he just rains blows down. That was Altamirano's last fight. Performance bonus.
He looked so good.
That matchup, he looked great in that one. He's a former LFA flyweight champ. He won on Contender Series against Carlos Candelario. A split decision win there for Altamirano. Loses the first round, won the second round, won the third round, in my humble opinion. But for Altamirano, what I absolutely love, and we saw a little bit of that in his UFC debut against Carlos Hernandez, Altamirano is one of those guys, you set it in gear, he goes, and he can turn it up as the fights go on, and I love to see that, especially in that fight against Candelario, where you saw him land a decent level of strikes in the first round. In the third round, it was up above 50 significant strikes, so you love to see that out of Altamirano. V-Fit House of Champions is the gym that he comes out of. He has a good grappling base, he does have a really good boxing base, likes to mix it up, to the head, to the body. Altamirano, one of those fundamentals guys. But the thing that scares me a little bit about him is he doesn't just start off hands high and they come down. He starts off with his hands about chest high and he can get clipped. And in a matchup against a guy like Salvador, that could get you caught.
Well, you bring it up too. The thing about Altamirano is he does have great cardio. He does have good output. But you bring it up, he lets his opponent set the pace initially and then he will match it. But if his opponent starts to, kind of pull away and put into second and third gear, it does take him a minute or two to to kind of reach that level and start to match it. So I will be curious to see at what pace does Salvador enter this fight at? Because again, he's one of these fighters, if he does start to burn hot, throw a lot of those hooks, mix in his own kicks, it will be interesting to see how Altamirano deals with that as a result, because Altamirano does have very good straight shots. I know I talked about the aggressiveness with him, and you normally assume he's very much a swarming fighter, and he can be that type of a guy, but when he is on the back foot, making his opponent walk into his power shots, that's really when he is at his best, and I think Salvador is going to give him the opportunity to fight with that style.
So Altamirano fought Daniel Da Silva. Vinicius Salvador was supposed to fight Daniel Da Silva, showed up for fight week, made the weight. Damn, Daniel came in 3 pounds overweight, and then he was forced out due to medical complications. So just unprofessional as it goes. But
well, if it's medical complications,
when it comes down to Vinicius Salvador,
does one know something?
Academy of He-Bosses, Vinicius Salvador, the nickname's Phenomeno, and he looked like a Phenomeno on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer. We talked a lot about Vinicius Salvador there on our preview show, so we're going to throw it back to that preview, get you up to speed on Salvador and how he matches up in this fight with Daniel Da Silva. The next fight, the co-main event, Shannon Ross. Listen, this is the one where I went down through it. He's 13-5. He's 33 years old at flyweight, where you're usually on your way out the door at that point. He hasn't competed at 125 pounds since 2018, and it's a little bit of a head scratcher of a fight. He's taking on Brazil's Vinicius Salvador. You go down through it, he was 12-4 before he beat a debuting fighter back not that long ago. So beating a debuting fighter at 12-4 gets you an opportunity on Dana White's Contender Series. And for Vinicius Salvador, he's beating guys he should beat. His record's padded. He's lost the guys that are all right.
Exactly.
But, like, I look at this one as, how far off the hill has Shannon Ross fallen? And for Vinicius Salvador, can you pull one out of the hat? Like, that's pretty much how I look at that fight.
That is the wild thing about Salvador and his record. He beats guys who have negative records or records that are around 500. And all of his losses are to anybody who has any good levels of experience under their belt. So this feels like one of those trapdoor fights no matter what. Because I do agree with you. Shannon Ross has some nice skills, don't get me wrong. But he is at the age and sort of at the point of his career where you do start to worry about how well he can fight at 125 pounds. And with Vinicius, it's more eye-catching, don't get me wrong, but that's the problem with his whole style. It's that if it looks good, it's going to look great. If it looks bad, it's going to look really bad. If he loses to Shannon Ross on this show, like, I don't really know where his future belongs at all. Because, again, if you just keep on losing anytime you fight people who have good records, but you can beat people who are making their debuts or who are that, like, 2-3 type fighters, then I'm very concerned about your overall ceiling.
Yeah, I mean, for Vinicius Salvador, spending time with such promotions as, like, the SFTs of the world, the Jungle Fights. I mean, fought with Max Fight, Pentagon Combat, Arena Global.
Shooto Brazil.
Like, yeah, Shooto Brazil. So every now and again, you get a diamond in the rough there, but it really is a tough one. So Vinicius Salvador goes out there and fights Shannon Ross on Dana White's Contender Series, knocks him down 3 times in that fight, and for some reason, Dana White gave Shannon Ross a contract, and he's going to have him on the UFC Perth card, the pay-per-view, the Volkanovski Makhachev card. I don't understand why either, because Salvador just went out there and landed everything he wanted, which is really weird because he has such odd angles.
He looked like a world beater in that fight, though. Like, if that's the only fight you've ever seen him be in, you think he could match up with Alex Pereira tomorrow and probably take him on. But he is what he is, and I think that's a fair thing to say about Vinicius Salvador. He is an extremely exciting fighter, and I don't think that's ever going to change. But the problem is, with a lot of guys like that, it's really difficult to figure out where their ceiling is, because there's kind of those exciting level of fighters at every stage of the way along your path to a UFC title. There's guys who are in that kind of technical brawling category who can make it to the top 5 and even become champions in some cases. Then there's a lot of brawlers, though, for being honest, who are just sort of lifelong borderline ranked fighters, and for Salvador, it'd be interesting to see if he could ever kind of buck the trend.
But for Salvador, we talked about this on the channel before. Stepdad used to have a poster with Brian McCabe on it that said the best offense is a good defense. And for Vinicius Salvador, it's the opposite. The best defense is a good offense, and he doesn't have striking defense at all.
I love watching it, though.
At all. And I wrote down as I was watching his fights, hey, he kind of fights like a flyweight Alex Oliveira. Vinicius Salvador throws hooks. Vinicius Salvador bangs. Now, he fought Shannon Ross again on Contender Series, who we saw him come into the UFC and get knocked out again. When you look at it for Salvador, the poorest level of competition I've ever seen of anybody coming into the UFC. He had that loss to Jafel Filho back 3 years, almost 4 years ago. Now, Filho lost to Makhachev, but he almost beat Makhachev.
Yeah.
So, Filho's a good fighter, but everybody from Wallace Vampirinho, who was a pro debuter before he fought Shannon Ross, it was just
when I saw that
guy.
name, I thought of that picture of Nicolas Cage from, like, the Middle Ages, and it's like, oh, that's the name of a vampire who's pretending to be a human. That's the name that you would pick. The frustrating thing about Salvador is, I really like his kicks and I like his hooks too, but it is weird. When you throw a lot of hooks, it's hard to synergize that with your kicking game. Normally when you throw a lot of kicks with your combinations, you throw straight shots, then you work the kicks in. Think of a Carlos Condit, a Holly Holm later on.
Think of Victor Altamirano.
Think of Victor Altamirano, exactly. So that is the weird thing about Salvador. I like the kicks in his game, I like the hooks in his game, but the two don't really work together all that well. He will kind of become a boxer, become a kicker on the outside. So I'm very curious to see if Altamirano can fight this as more of a kickboxer and less of a boxer. I do think he's going to have a great opportunity to win this matchup, but this is one of those fights where I don't know if the judges are going to be needed. I just think the aggressiveness in both guys' styles, and both guys are pretty hittable. Like, Altamirano proved that the last time out especially. Daniel Da Silva does, he's good. Like, he hits hard, he's aggressive, but I think we know the weaknesses are definitely there in his game at this point. Vinicius Salvador can definitely take advantage of all of those same weaknesses in this matchup, and I even think his power is what Da Silva's is turned up a notch.
Oh yeah, Vinicius Salvador has power in spades, and if you're looking for Altamirano last time out, my comparison that I wrote down on my notes was, he looked like a pocket version of Dricus Duplass. He was walking him across the cage, and then at the end of every combination of flurry, he'd either throw a low kick, a kick to the body, or he'd throw one high, and you really like to see a guy mixing it up that way. When you have a look at the odds, they're very, very close. Ever so slightly, they edge Vinicius Salvador. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, they are to you. Now, I should say this. We both had Altamirano to beat Daniel Da Silva. We both had Salvador to beat Daniel Da Silva as well, so throw that one out there. I'm going to say over, under. I think it'll be close.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say over under 67.5% Salvador.
I think it'll be under.
I think it's going to be under. And it is under. 513 total votes, 55% Altamirano, 70% having to win by decision for the 45% that have Salvador, 43% by decision. And somebody last week complained that you guys always say that you're surprised with the Tapology votes. This is one of those times because the favorite isn't actually the fan vote in this one.
I was going to say, I think Altamirano, I actually have Victor Altamirano in this fight. I know it's a very dangerous matchup for him, but there's a reason I brought up straight shots and hooks like 7 times in this preview and breakdown. I worry about Salvador walking into a lot of those straight shots from Altamirano. Now, if he is able to collapse that range, go to the body, work in some of those hooks, of course he can have success, but that's a very difficult range to initially get past. And I don't think Altamirano is one of these guys who's going to eat a couple shots and then fade as the fight goes on. I do think he's going to have that lasting ability. So I realize it's a very dangerous fight for both guys, but I do have the slight, it's a pick 'em fight. I guess I just have Victor Altamirano in the matchup.
Matt, Victor Altamirano is the youngest looking 32-year-old. Vinicius Salvador is the oldest looking 26-year-old, so a little bit of Benjamin Button going on there. I like Victor Altamirano because I didn't mention it, but Salvador holds hands low, period. And I know Altamirano getting dropped his last time out does definitely raise some alarm bells. I did like it. He had a little bit of Shannon Ross in him because he got dropped, his eyes were to the ceiling, and then he right back into it, popped right back up. Dan Daniel can hold some guys down. We've seen Da Silva have some pockets of glory in his UFC tenure, even though he's lost all three by finish. I do like the fundamentals out of Victor Altamirano, I'm feeding that fed horse. But both of us going with the man representing Mexico and Texas, and Victor Altamirano should get a big pop out of that San Antonio crowd in the Alamo City. Some big-time fights on this card, including one up a division from this. Man, Marlon Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen. Can't wait for it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at Flyweight, can Daniel Da Silva Lacerda's wildness lead him to victory, or will it lead him to a fourth straight loss by finish? We're going to find out, and he's going to be taking on the Pete Sprott Muay Thai protege. It's CJ Vergara. As always, we're getting excited for another flyweight matchup. I say that every single weekend when we do have one of these flyweight fights, because these two guys aren't in the rankings. They're not in the fringes of the rankings. They're closer to the bottom than they are to the top of the overall hierarchy when it comes to this division. But both guys have had their moments, even in their fights, and that might sound a little bit squirrely considering what I just said about Daniel Da Silva, who's been listed as Lacerda coming into the UFC, then it's Da Silva. Now if you look up his fights on Fight Pass, it's all Lacerda all the time. But for Miojo and the guy whose first name is Daniel, if you look at him, just numbers on a page, even just fighter on his Instagram page, and I'll throw up a picture there, he's always posing with the celebrities. He is a guy out of Shoot the Box, Diego Lima, so there's a lot
of pictures with him, with Charles Oliveira, Alan Nascimento, Thomas Almeida, a lot of really good fighters out of that gym. And Daniel Da Silva, what he was known for outside of the UFC before he made his foray into it, was his spinning attacks, his really, really edgy ground game, because he'd really try and force position quickly. And inside of the UFC, I can break down the fights, Matt, in under 15 seconds.
This Daniel Da Silva. Well, I don't know, come on now. This is the thing about Daniel Da Silva. He reminds me of a guy who you watch in, like, college basketball, and you think he's going to be really good, scores a ton of points, then he gets drafted at the end of the second round and, like, doesn't play for an NBA team. Because when you want to talk about the positives, and when you see some of those positives come out in his fighting style, they're easy to get excited about, because he is so aggressive, and he's a guy who's looking for a finish at every moment throughout the fight. Now, will he get caught sometimes because he is so aggressive looking for those finishes? Yes, he will, but that's the weird thing about these fighters, and I don't want to get into the odds just yet, but I know we will talk about them near the end of the video, but these two fighters, to me, are in very different categories of, like, UFC opponents, if you will, because Vergara's one of these guys, we talk with him all the time now. He's got a good baseline of skills, so I really like him as an opponent for these up-and-coming prospects. We saw it in his last matchup against Tetsuo Taeha. We know how good of a prospect he is, how dominant his wrestling can be, and that was a bridge too far, if you will, for CJ Vergara, but I still like what his skill set is. We know what he can give us, we know what he isn't going to give us, and that's the weird thing about Da Silva. He's been given a lot of chances at this point, and I know the flashes are brilliant, and they do make him look really good. It's just, at this point in his career, I wonder if he can just sustain a game plan long enough to deal with a guy like Vergara, who, if anything, he's pretty tough, he keeps a decent pace, he's not going to leave those big openings that a guy like Da Silva will, and that's why this fight is so interesting to me, because it's a tale of two very different fighters.
So Daniel might as well switch his nickname or his last name to Daniel Fredette, if that's what we're going based off
of. A little bit, yeah. He could go to China and be the greatest, though.
But we're looking at Daniel. I think Daniel has a really easy path to victory against a guy like CJ Vergara. Vergara leaves a lot of openings on the feet. And the other thing about both these guys is, we touched on it earlier in the Vinicius Salvador fight, but Daniel Da Silva was supposed to fight him back in December. Da Silva missed weight by 3 pounds. He was forced off of the card. CJ Vergara is cut from that same cloth. He missed weight against Tatsuro Taeda. He missed weight when he came in on short notice in his debut against Ody Osborne. He also missed weight on the regional scene for a Fury FC flyweight title against Solis. And in that fight, he won it, but he's missed weight 3 times. He's had bantamweight fights where he's just a little bit under.
And he's not huge for the division.
He's had catchweight fights as well. But for Daniel Da Silva, 3 fights, really quick. And this is where I want to hammer home this point. Fights Jeff Molina. Jeff Molina, in that fight, first round, runs across the cage, gets his back really, really quickly, slips out of position. Molina ends up on top. Second round, Molina drops him once, gets on top, stacks guard, finishes him by TKO. Then he takes on Francisco Figueiredo. Has a really good fundamental game plan in that one. Gets the fight down to the mat, gets caught in a knee bar. He's not Gumby. He's not Muhammad Makhachev. Figueiredo takes on that knee. And then his last time out, he takes on Victor Altamirano. He drops Victor early. He then gets taken down and finished. Stack guard, Altamirano gets the finish. For Vergara, in his debut, takes on Ode Osborne, loses by unanimous decision. Most people thought that he beat Ode Osborne in that fight. Then he takes on Cledison Rodriguez. He wins that fight by split decision. Most people thought Rodriguez won that one. And his last time out against Taeda, he got controlled for large portions of the first round. Second round, a little bit of a rebound until he ends up succumbing to that armbar. A submission that I guess you don't really see as often in the men's MMA, but it's making a comeback if you watch the fights as of late. So again, we look at this one. Daniel Da Silva, the last thing I will say, we'll give him his credit where it's due. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu brown belt, and before he came into the UFC, he was a casket maker, a little bit ominous. His hero? The big man upstairs,
Matt. The Undertaker?
Oh, okay. Not the Undertaker, Jesus Christ, or both. I mean, listen, he's coming for your soul. But when it comes down to this one, we have a look at the odds. Yes, CJ Vergara is about a 3-1 favorite. I feel like it's a little unjust based on both of their performances because, again, CJ Vergara's best form is the guy that knocked out Bruno Correa, lands that right hook, drops him, and then hits him with the knee, and it's all over. But a guy who can keep a pace throughout a fight is CJ Vergara. Daniel Da Silva, he burns hot. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Vergara.
I think they'll be over.
I think they're going to be over. They are way over 696 total votes. 93% Vergara, 60% by knockout for the 7% that have Da Silva, 41% by decision. The sexy pick is the underdog pick, Matt and Daniel Da Silva. I can't find myself going with him
in this one. Exactly.
But I do think he has a better opportunity than the odds and the fans would suggest because
Daniel De Silva is one of those guys that can land really good counters. He has a hard time gauging distance, and that's what I think might get him
caught. But you can't fault any of the Tapology voters or the odds makers for putting Daniel De Silva in this place. Like, I agree with you. He is more dangerous than the odds would suggest, but this isn't one of those fights where I'm like, oh my goodness, Daniel De Silva's a plus 220. He has been finished in numerous fights, in all of them. And it's just, it is concerning because even when he does have a little bit of success, he doesn't really keep it going. He will end up making that one big mistake, and those big mistakes will get you caught against a guy like Vergara, who might not have the highest ceiling in the division, but he has a steady enough floor, I think, just because, again, we know what he's decent at, so I do have Vergara in the matchup, but it should be a fun fight.
Once Pete Spratt fought Robbie Lawler, and years down the line, people say, remember that time CJ Vergara fought Daniel De Silva? Both of us going with the man that's fighting at home, San Antonio, Texas's own CJ Vergara, to get the win. Some big-time matchups on the card, including a main event up a weight class. It's Marlon Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Coming up this weekend at welterweight, we have a home state welcome for the problem, Trevin Giles, and he's going to be welcoming in Duval County's own Preston Parsons. Matt, a lot of P's in that name, and a lot of question marks for me in this fight, because for Trevin Giles, I mean, the weight changes throughout the career arc is a little bit like Jared Cannonier, but for Giles, he started off undefeated, came into the UFC. He had pre-UFC wins against Brandon Allen, Ryan Spann, all at middleweight. And then he makes that debut against James Bochnevich, finishes him at 205 pounds, back down to middleweight. He has a lot of success. He loses two fights in a row to Zach Cummings and Gerald Meerschaert. Then he finds his footing again. But the comments and the questions around Trevin Giles were, hey, I'm always going to make my way down to welterweight. So for Giles, he loses a really, really gritty, tough fight against Dricus du Plessis. He's having a ton of success. And then all of a sudden, Dricus decides, oh, I can hit now. Yeah. And then he moves down to welterweight, does Trevin Giles. He takes on Michael Morales. Little bit of success here and there in that fight, but ultimately it's Morales getting the win for Giles. His last time out, first win at welterweight in his career against Luis Cosi. Yes, Orion's brother. And in that fight, Matt, listen, we watch fights, so you don't necessarily have to. So take me at my word from watching that fight in great detail. It was one of the worst fights I've watched this year, going back and doing tape study. It was awful.
I've watched the bad ones, I gotta be honest.
Nothing happened. Trevin Giles lands marginally more volume on the outside while both guys stare in a mirror. And in that fight, Matt, in the first round, Daniel Cormier says, and I quote, "It's 2 minutes now. We've got to fight."
I watched it, don't worry. My issue with Trevin Giles is there's different versions of him out there, and you just don't know which one you're going to get at this point. And I do think there is a bit of a Goldilocks zone to his career, that being 185 pounds, because him cutting down to 170, he is big for the division. Like, he doesn't look small at welterweight, I will give him that. But you worry about where his durability is going to be at, because with Giles, he didn't even really seem like he wanted to jump into the pocket against Cosi. And I get it, Cosi's a big guy, he does have power, but if you're a boxer like Trevin Giles, with your level of technique, with your hand speed, something we bring up every single time we talk about Trevin, you would think if any matchup in the UFC would be comfortable at least getting in and getting out, using that footwork, using that speed, it would be the Cosi matchup. And we both talked about this, like, it's a win, but you can lose stock in wins and you can gain stock in losses. And I don't know how many fans jumped aboard Trevin Giles' fan boat, if you will, just because of that matchup. But I will say this, and you brought it up and I'm happy you did. He had the level of competition that you look for coming into the UFC, because there's a lot of the times we talk about fighters, they might have some losses on their record, they might have some impressive wins, but when your level of competition normally goes on to then compete in the UFC and look pretty good, that does speak to your development before the UFC. But I guess that's kind of the question I'm bringing back around to you. Do you feel like Giles has gotten a lot better since he's been in the UFC, or have we just kind of seen the same fighter in different weight divisions? Because we know how good the boxing technique is. Again, I keep on bringing up the hand speed. It just feels like he isn't very much the same guy.
I mean, you got to hold the phone before I answer your question. You keep talking about his fans. You keep talking about his boxing. Have you been over to his Instagram?
I have.
Yeah, he's pumping up his OnlyFans. Lots of pictures of him boxing there. You know what I want to see on OnlyFans, Matt? A, nothing. B, don't want to pay. And C, Trevin Jones boxing. Probably neither, but realistically, definitely not Trevin Giles boxing. He wants to pump that Instagram. Just guys out there, and so is Trevin Giles. But when I focus on answering your question, Trevin Giles in the UFC is 6-4. He had a fight of the night at UFC 247 against a guy who's not allowed to coach in the UFC anymore.
And we can say his name. He's not Voldemort. James Krebs.
Yeah, tough fight.
But you can say the name.
6-4, and the best part about it for Trevin Giles in a fight like this, he's 7-0 fighting in his home state of Texas.
So he didn't answer my question.
He does have that going for him. I think it's pretty much the same version of him. If you watch Trevin Giles fights, and I watched the Bokhnevich fight, I watched him fighting against Brendan Allen, I went back and watched him fight Ryan Spann and Ike Villanueva, it's a lot of loosey-goosey movement on the outside. And Trevin Giles, to his credit, has a really nice background in the martial arts. And that is what you like. You do see a nice flow to his strikes. But the thing for Giles that does concern me out of all of this is he's got a really low output. He doesn't tend to get hit a lot, but it's 2.9 to 1.99 strikes landed to strikes absorbed per minute. And you can see that in these fights, not just the fight against Kosi, but even in the fights that he's winning. He tends to have decent takedown defense. He has good takedowns on his own.
He moves very well, yeah.
He has a win over Roman Dolidze that ages well, even though, again, I thought Roman beat Marvin Vettori, but that's neither here nor there. You look at the fights that he's had throughout, and he's hit as a big favorite in some of his wins, but he's also missed as a favorite as well. The fight against Zach Cummings, the fight that he had against Gerald Meerschaert, Cummings comes up and rocks him and drops Giles. And as Giles gets back up to his feet, Zach Cummings goes, well, hey, I'm not a middleweight. I'm just
He's thick in the middle.
He was thick in the middle in that fight. And as Giles getting back up, he just pulls guillotine in the third round. Nothing to lose like Billy Talent when no one knows your name. Zach Cummings gets a win. And Zach Cummings is going to be fighting off a near 3-year layoff in that Kansas City card coming up. So if you like the old prospector, you like Zach Cummings in that matchup. When you look at this one, though, it feels like it's actually custom made for Trevin Giles in a fight like this, because Preston Parsons,
we've said
for
that
what
before,
it's worth,
though.
Preston Parsons will box on the outside, and he did a great job of that his last time out against Evan Elder. It was the complete package of his skill set against Elder. Picked up the win there. 2 30-27s, 1 30-26. Parsons not necessarily a boxer, but he tends to keep his hands in tight. He closes the distance, and then he throws once he's in, but he sticks around for the receipt, as Teddy Atlas says every now and again. But the best part about it for Parsons is he owns his own gym as a very, very young man. Elevate MMA. I said it with Duval County in Jacksonville. I'll throw the picture up there. He's hanging out with Stephen Coslow, who's Obi-Wan Kenobi the Pillow. Like, just a great nickname there. Stephen Coslow. I think he might be a welterweight at this point.
Could be.
Bantamweight. He is a big, big guy right now. But when you focus on it for Preston Parsons, many, many wins by submission. He is a very dominant grappler. We saw it be too much too soon on a very short notice call in the debut against Daniel Rodriguez. At least he made it out of the first round. Got finished in the second round. But if you do look through it, his third pro fight was against Mike Perry, which you can't fault a guy way back then to lose. And then the other loss that he has, second round rear naked choke in 2017 to Valdir Arujo. That's a guy that has a win over Nate Marquardt and has fought a very high level competition. Chris Weidman, Brett Cooper, and Alex Morono as well. So Preston Parsons has been in some tricky, tricky spots, but
I just worry about his ability to get the takedown in this matchup, because that's the thing about Giles. You might think about the negatives more so than the positives at this stage of his career, because I was pretty high on him when he came into the UFC, and I thought he was going to continue to get better, but I do think he has kind of just maintained the same, and there's nothing wrong with that. He is very skilled, but guys are starting to learn what to do with him. If you can just overwhelm him with the volume, and that's easier said than done, of course. Again, he has good hand speed, he has good power, and when he does let his hands go, he is very effective, but that's the frustrating thing. There'll be these long moments of inactivity throughout his fights where minutes go by and you're like, hey, Trevin, you can't throw punches right now, buddy. But the issue is, I don't know if this is an opponent who could really make him pay for some of those in-betweens. I think Parsons can have success on the outside, but is he really going to be that dominant in those 45 seconds to minute exchanges where, okay, Parsons is going to take over? Now, if he gets this to the mat, it will be interesting, because Giles can grapple defensively. It's not like he's a fish out of water by any means, but Parsons uses his frame very well. I know 5'11 at welterweight, it's not the biggest, but the way he uses his body is very well. He's not one of these athletic guys like a Kevin Lee who can just hold you down. He really does like the wrist control level too, and I think that'll be an important thing in this matchup. But again, I keep on going back to how easy will it be for Parsons to get that takedown? I think it's going to be difficult.
It's going to be weird for Parsons too, because he is one of those guys that has low hands, likes to walk guys down, and then counter strike at the same time. Those colors don't always run, but for Preston Parsons, it's equaled more wins than losses, and he's in the UFC. You have a look at the odds. They are very close, ever so slightly shading. Trevin Giles, the problem, a guy who's already had 10 fights in the UFC. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt, and this is where it gets interesting, because it surprised us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Giles with the UFC experience.
I think it'll be over. He's the more well-known commodity.
Definitely the more well-known guy, and he is 663 total votes, 75% Giles, 78% by decision for the 25% that are Parsons, 50% by decision, 29% by submission. For Preston Parsons, 10 wins, 1 by decision. The rest are by submission. The 1 by decision was his last time out against Elder, who we definitely hold in higher regard than some of these other guys that are making their UFC debuts of late. So Matt, when you're trying to make the pick on this one, obviously the shine goes to the problem. Can Preston pressure the problem?
I think I've got every Trevin Giles fight wrong, if I'm being completely honest. Oh. I just, every time I pick his fights, I am incorrect on them. Because, again, I like the skills that he has. He just doesn't always show them, and that's the frustrating thing. It's like when people talk about Anthony Davis. He's one of the top five most talented players in the league. But does that talent actually get showcased on a daily basis? Now, I am picking Trevin in this matchup for the reasons I brought up. I think he can do enough on those in-betweens to damage Parsons and avoid the big shots. And if he doesn't get hurt by a big shot at 170, which does concern me a little bit, we've talked about the weight cut a few times now, I do like Giles in the matchup. But I can admit, this could be a bit of a stale fight. And if he loses this one, I really don't know what they're going to do with him if he moves up in weight, if he stays here, because this really has been a bit of a drop down for him. When you think about it, he was fighting Dricus du Plessis at middleweight not that long ago. Like, that's a really well-respected fighter at middleweight.
I got Preston Parsons. I mean, 5 seconds into his fight against Evan Elder, he was running across the cage going for the takedown. For me, I do like the grappling sequences that I've seen out of Parsons when he was with Titan, when he was on the regional scene. And for Trevin, it's more, I'm going to get up, then I'm going to hang around and try and grapple. So for me, I do like Preston Parsons in the matchup. He's more active guy, and I like to see him over the 3 rounds. I finally got that sample size out of him his last time out. So Matt, we're split on the pick. I'm going with Parsons, you're going with Giles. Let us know, because I want to hear from you guys down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. Some big time fights left on this card, including that bantamweight tilt, the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. In 2021, Steven Peterson said, I am boycotting the Texas Commission. In 2022, he had a fight of the year contender with Julian Arosa. In 2023, he's going to be welcoming Lucas Alexander to the home state, the Lone Star State, the man out of Fortis MMA. Is Steven Peterson, or for Peterson, he's been around and in the minds of fans since the OG season of Dana White's Contender Series 2017. Peterson didn't get the win there. It was actually Benito Lopez who was able to do it. But if you look at it for Peterson in the UFC, 3-4. If you look at the 5 on in, it's 2-3. But even some of these fights could have gone either way. I mean, he has a loss to Luis Pena. The fight that really kind of got him the wrong way was the fight against Alex Caceres that he lost by decision. Very close fight. Finished Martin Bravo.
One
performance
of
the night bonus. He beat Chase Hooper in a giant upset, and then his last time out, as I mentioned, he loses a split decision to Julian Arosa. But you go down through all of this and you look at it. Every single fight before Steven Peterson fought on Dana White's Contender Series, he went 15-5. All 20 of those fights were in Texas. So he was kind of salty about that Caceres fight. I went down through it. 7 on MMA decision scored it 29-28 Peterson, and 7 scored it 29-28 Caceres.
Again, we talk about losses where you can gain stock and wins where you can lose it. I never thought in a million years Steven Peterson would have a close fight with Alex Caceres, guys, and I will raise my hand and admit when I'm wrong. I thought he looked really good in that matchup. Now, granted, I thought Caceres did enough to win the fight, but it was an odd, kind of hesitant Alex Caceres, and to Steven Peterson's credit, because here's the thing, you can always guarantee this in a Peterson fight. Is he going to be worried about moving forward? Not at all. He thinks that's the only rule in MMA is that you can't take a step backwards. Now, it makes the viewing experience phenomenal because Steven Peterson is regularly involved in really boring fights. And I do like that at least we know how aggressive he's going to be. Because even when I bring up Alex Caceres, who is an extremely talented fighter, he has all the talent, but we don't always see it every performance. Peterson might not have Yair Rodriguez striking or Alexander Volkanovski technique, And I know you hate this term. He got that dog in him, though. And that's what I really do like about Peterson.
Hold on. You're telling me a guy that tattooed the Superman logo on his chest has
with, like,
dog
chains
in him?
Around it? But that's the thing. You look at his record, you think 19 and 10. You might roll your eyes at that. But he is extremely aggressive. He can take a shot to give a shot. He has great lasting power in the UFC. The one thing I will say about Peterson, though, is, and I bring this up about Caceres, he will have moments where he just walks forward, but he doesn't set things up behind the just marching forward. His stance will kind of square to where his shoulders are just walking forward on his opponent, and that's the version that's almost a little bit too overconfident. Again, I like that part of his game to where he is aggressive. He makes his opponents feel very uncomfortable, but in some matchups, it is one of those double-edged swords to where it can get him caught, so I'll be really interested to see how Alexander does deal with some of that pressure, especially you being a debuting fighter coming in against Steven Peterson. Like, it's a tough ask for anybody.
Well, it's a tough ask, and you made a little bit of an oopsie
sorry,
there.
Not debut.
For Lucas Alexander, he made his debut on 6 days' notice, replacing Melzik Bogdasarian against Joanderson Brito. Nobody thought that he would win. Joanderson Brito even less so, because he went in there, just cut the distance, was able to get the takedown off of an Alexander head kick from a phone booth apart.
It was
right there. Went head kick with a hip high. He slipped, and then Brito just was able to get the back and then ultimately get him in the choke and get the submission win.
I thought Brito versus Peterson, if Peterson is able to win.
Yeah, big time win there, but a first round finish loss for Lucas Alexander. And if you go down through Alexander's record, it wasn't that I wasn't sold on Alexander fighting Brito, if I can be completely honest and candid with everyone. I wasn't sold on Alexander at all. I mean, his level of competition was very, very poor. And you got to commend a guy early on in his career to kind of have the forethought to have these fights in the States, to be training at a Fusion XL. A lot of great fighters out of there. Philip Rose won. Adolfo Vieira. We saw Jacques Rissouz out of there for part of his
career. Did Mike Perry make that gym famous, oddly enough?
Mike Perry, BKFC's own. But when you go down through the record, and if you're just comparing it, and records are for DJs, I know this, but for Lucas Alexander, best win in coming into the UFC was his win in the main event of Anthony Pettis FC number 1 against Jacob Kilburn. He threw a nice amount of kicks in the first round. He threw that kick low to the body that Kilburn went to block, and then Kilburn looked like he broke his arm or his wrist in that one. He shakes it off, the referee runs in, and that's the end of the fight. So a good win for Lucas Alexander, but I know we kind of touched on it in his debut and looking forward to him. What are some of the positives that we had of Alexander? One of the best leg kicks you're going to see out there on the regional scene. Really low hands, like he's riding a chopper, and then he just likes to throw a lot of hooks.
It's very Fedor from Pride-esque. That's where he holds his hands, very low.
Not a lot of straight shots, not a ton of volume, some good power from Lucas Alexander. The jiu-jitsu is a little bit of a question mark. Obviously, it got him caught against Brito, but there were other things that led to that finish, and Brito's going to get you if you're going to leave that out there. But you have a look at it. I mean, Steven Peterson, he's had these fights in the UFC. He fights at an incredibly high output, but he also absorbs a lot of damage. He had a fight of the night really, really as early on as you can in your UFC career against Brandon Davis. So you go down through this one. It's the fact that Lucas Alexander is typically the biggest fighter that he's, you know, the biggest fighter that's in the cage at that given time.
He's
at featherweight.
Big
frame. Big featherweight. And you look at it for Steven Peterson, he's kind of going to be able to match that a little bit. Not necessarily in reach, a little bit less and a little bit less in height. But both guys should be very close when it does come to weigh-in day. And again, Peterson gets that kind of comfort of, well, I train out of Fortis MMA, not that far of a fight for him. So you have a look at the odds. Peterson is actually favored in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Peterson.
I think they'll be under.
You think they're going to be under? Oh, look at that. 648 total votes, 73% Peterson, 81% by decision for the 27% that have Alexander, 60% by decision. And I think for a lot of people, I'm kind of surprised they're going with Alexander to win by decision in that respect.
It'd be by knockout.
I know Peterson is tougher than a $2 steak, but Alexander's one of those guys that could catch you off balance.
Well, when you're walking forward, too, if you're fighting a guy who already has pretty darn good punching power and you're just moving forward on that punching power, it's going to make it hit a lot harder. And that's why this is one of those fights where Peterson, I think, is going to win by decision. That is my prediction. I like Peterson in the matchup. I like his aggressiveness. I like his output. But, and this is a big but, his fighting style opens the window for anybody who has punching power to win a fight. You don't become 19 and 10 by being better than everybody technically in every area of the game. So I love watching Steven Peterson fight. I think this will be a really entertaining fight. And hopefully Alexander can at least take this a little bit late so we learn a little bit more about him, because you didn't learn a lot about him in his debut. Granted, like, Brie 2, I think it's fair to say, is a level above. But I have Peterson in the matchup, and I'm excited for the fight. I do think he can make it interesting.
Peterson, his last two times out, he missed weight, 148.5 against Chase Hooper, 149 against Julian Rosa. Fight of the night, where's my money? Well, your opponent gets to keep that. So you go down through it. Peterson has struggled on the scale in the past. We wish him well in the weight cut, and hopefully the Texas commission is off of his back.
Hopefully.
Both of us going with Steven Peterson in the matchup. I think his style is conducive to a win in this one. Some big time fights on this card. Matt, co-main event, Holly Holm taking on Yana Santos. Not going to want to miss that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Weird fight in the featherweight division coming up this weekend. We have a man that almost reached the pinnacle with the PFL in the pit, Daniel Pineda. He's going to be taking on Top Gun Tucker Lutz. A couple of guys where inactivities really caused him issues. For Pineda's last time out was in early summer 2021. Tucker Lutz, not that far after that. For both of these guys, injuries, the reasons why we haven't seen them. And I listened to a couple of different interviews that shed some light on both of their respective plights. But when you do look at this matchup, Matt, I mean, you consider it. Daniel Pineda runs around Tucker Lutz in terms of experience.
Oh, like, yeah,
I think that has to be said. For Pineda, he fought on a card where, I mean, Dana White famously said, that's f***ing illegal. But he fought on an Elite XC card where Kimbo Slice made his pro debut and KJ Nunes finished Nick Diaz. Can you believe that? Daniel Pineda fought on that card.
Daniel Pineda, been there, done that.
He's like an old leather boot,
Daniel But that's Pineda. The great thing about Daniel Pineda. I know he came to the UFC at a weird point in his career, and I think that's fair to say, because there's a lot of
fighters. Whoa. The first time he didn't, the second
that's
time
true,
he did.
Sorry. This run that he is currently on, I'm a little bit curious about what his overall ceiling could be, because you kind of knew what we were going to get. Does he have a bad gas tank? Is the sky blue? Do bears shit in the woods? Yeah, he doesn't have a great gas tank, but if he gets guys on the ground and gets on top of them, does he normally destroy them and make it look really easily? Yeah, he does. And that's the thing about Pineda. The one skill that he has, which is his offensive grappling, his jiu-jitsu, his wrestling, I would say. But
his powerful striking.
His powerful striking, too. But the thing about his striking is, I consider that a little bit more 50-50. It can get him caught, and especially if he's throwing a lot of big, wild power shots. And that's the thing about Pineda that I will be curious to see. How much is timing a part of his game? I know he's been there, he's done that. We talk about the experience quite a bit, but with the time off, I'll be curious to see what version of him we do get. Is it still going to be that balls to the wall, I'm going to go right at Tucker Lutz, try to get him down and throw my power shots? Because if we do get that version of him, I got to be honest, we didn't have this on the Fight of the Night screen. We could get a pretty great 6-minute fight of the night, I think, in the featherweight division.
So he did an interview, did Daniel Pineda, with MMA sucker James Lynch, and he said, okay, last time he fought, it was injuries. So James tried to press him on that one, and his response was, and I quote, a little bit of lower body. He was very kind of coy about
He's like the Washington Capitals in 2013, just what, being very, very
what the injury was. He said, they told me it would be a year, year and a half to try and get back. He was able to kind of rehab it, work through it, didn't necessarily need the surgery. But he also touched on the fact that he's looking to make this another fight of the night style fight, and he wants to go out there and get another finish. Because if you look at it, 27 wins, 27 finishes. And I don't know if I've ever seen a 5-on-in where the guy was 1-1 with 3 no contests. But let me try and explain all of these fights to you.
It might take a minute.
For Daniel Pineda, he had success in the UFC his first turn. And I know he's really sour that he left on kind of a bad note. But he fought a really high-level competition. He was with Legacy. He fought Pat Schilling in the UFC debut, finished him. Then he fought Mackin Smerzier. He finished him in the first round. He fought Mikey Brown from American Top Team, lost Antonio Carvalho, beat Justin Lawrence, lost to Barrandau and Robert Whiteford. Pretty good fighters. And then he went out there and beat Leonard Garcia with Legacy. But he went back, he fought for Fury, fought for Legacy, did Daniel Pineda, and then all of a sudden he was in the PFL season. And it was the second season of the PFL, or rather it was the first season of the PFL. He beat Mavlud Haibulayev in 29 seconds. Mavlud's a very good fighter. Then he beat JBC Junior Bacon Cheeseburger Jeremy Kennedy in the first round. In the same night! They end up as a no contest because the Nevada State Athletic Commission said that his testosterone levels were too high. He then takes off just about a year, and the UFC signs him. And I should mention, out of those two wins that Pineda had in the same night,
He was then supposed to fight in the finals against Lance Aparty Palmer. Could have had an opportunity at $1 million. So, Pineda makes his UFC debut against other Burns. He takes on Herbert Burns, one championship's own. He had a lot of success there. And in that fight, he was a +210 underdog. And after that fight, he had a performance bonus, Matt. And he looked amazing in that fight.
Going into that.
Then Pineda fights Cub Swanson, and we have a big pendulum shift in the odds.
Cub Swanson looked like the greatest fighter of all time.
At the end of the first round and the second
round. The combination he landed was
Pineda was a -175 favorite in the matchup. Pineda looked great to start the fight.
Exactly.
Cub Swanson was coming off major ACL surgery. Pineda was targeting the legs with great leg kicks. It's something he's known for in his career. Finished Khabibulyev that way. And in that fight, he starts to slow down at the end of the first round. By the second round, he's spent. So then he takes another 6 months off, does Pineda. He fights Andre Feely. And I counted him getting dropped and stunned 3 times in the first round. Body kicks, hooks, punches, everything that Feely was hitting was landing on Pineda, who just kept rushing the distance. He had no success with his grappling. And in the second round, I know it's a no contest accidental eye poke. It was a no contest accidental eye poke. It was right in there for a long time. So you hate to see the fight ending that way because Feely was having this success. But for Pineda, it also sucks. He was booked to take on Jamal Emmers last year, but obviously the injuries aggravated that. For Tucker Lutz, the same thing, Matt, can be said because he's the type of guy that also fights with a really high pace, like Daniel Pineda. But Lutz has kind of gotten away from what got him to the dance, which was those early, early finishes that he had. And I listened to an interview that he did on Behind the Cage Door with Jake Lippmann. So credit to Jake Lippmann. And in that fight, Tucker Lutz says he had a lot of different issues with the injuries. And quote, I've been having some nagging injury that flared up real bad with my back. So I was on the shelf all of last year, kind of rehabbing and getting good. And luckily able to swerve surgeries was his quote. So listen, Tucker Lutz is going through those back injuries. Obviously in his UFC debut, he looked great against a fellow Texan, kind of similar to Daniel Pineda, in Kevin Aguilar. And then his last time out, he took on Pat Sabatini. And Sabatini's grappling and control, which kind of sucks for a guy that trains at a team ground control for Tucker Lutz. He got ground controlled in that one. So for Lutz, it didn't necessarily work out. His background actually is wrestling, is Tucker Lutz, but his boxing is really what gets it done in a lot of these fights.
It is quite crisp, and he does do a good job of incorporating the power shot in with just his combinations, kind of the pitter-patter up top. And I think he'll be able to use that to great success in this matchup. But I would love to see Lutz go to the body more in this matchup. I think it will be open against a guy like Pineda.
In the fight against Kevin Aguilar, he popped the jab and then he threw a right.
But that's what I mean. Just keep that going when you're fighting Pineda, because Pineda will strike with his hands down, get clipped, and then immediately bring them up. When he immediately brings them up, that body is wide open more often than not. So I do think that's something Lutz can take advantage of as this fight goes on. And you're right, Lutz was a guy who did burn extremely hot earlier on in his career, was getting a lot of earlier finishes, but he toned it down in a positive way, I would say. It's not like Shane Carwin when he toned it down and he lost 40 pounds of muscle. That might have been due to other stuff now that I'm talking about it. We don't need to talk about it, but you get the idea. For Lutz, his less aggressive style has actually turned in a lot more positive results, and I'd be very curious to see if that game plan will be able to carry him against Pineda, because that's the thing. If Lutz shows up to fight in the first round and Pineda does too, this is going to be some of the crazier and 5 minutes of action you've ever seen.
Yeah, he mentioned that in the interview with Jake Lippmann, that I haven't had a finish in a while, which has been bothersome to me, because he wants to go out there and really
throw down.
We could
get a pretty good fight.
And if you look at it for Lutz, I mean, he's a national amateur kickboxing champion, and that total combined opponent record coming into the UFC was 59-52. So not really the best level of competition that Lutz had faced. Daniel Pineda's faced some of the best that you're going to find out there. Lutz is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. When you have two guys coming off of a really, really long layoffs, I kind of want to stay away from it, especially when guys want to come in with fight of the night style fights, and they are definitely finishers. It scares you off of picking either one of them. But we have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say that the fans ever so, like, I'm going to say over under 70% Lutz.
I think it'll be over, and I have a reason why.
And it is over because you looked.
No.
686 total votes, 85% Lutz, 77% by decision. What? For the 15% that have Pineda, 46% by decision. He's never won by decision. 32% by knockout. The fans overwhelmingly see this one going to a decision.
I don't, but who's your pick here?
I worry about Potato's gas tank on a good day. He's 37 years old and he's taking years off. I worry about his gas tank quite a bit against Tucker Lutz. Now, is this a fight that's going to determine the next champion of the featherweight division? No, I don't think it is, but I do like Tucker Lutz in the matchup. I do worry about the negatives being more accentuated from a guy like Pineda with all of this time off. I'll be the first one to admit if I'm wrong if that is the case on Saturday, but I do have Lutz in the matchup.
Tucker Lutz in his UFC Q&A, it says he has a PhD from the School of Hard Knocks. Matt, that hits hard.
Does he eat nails for breakfast spelled tough with two Fs?
I like when he throws combinations and he goes to the head and then he dips down to the body. As I said, he incorporates the body kick. So I like Tucker Lutz in the matchup. It's a really, really volatile one out there. I'd really like to hear from you down below in the comment section as to who you have, because featherweight is on fire and we got some really good fights on this card. You're not going to want to miss any of them. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of 34-year-old middleweight showstoppers coming up this weekend, and some guys that more than likely had their best days in other organizations. We have the former welterweight and middleweight champ from the ACB in Albert Duraev, and he's going to be looking to take on Chitty Bang Bang and Joe Kuwani. Matt, this fight is a lot of fun. Albert Duraev in both of his fights in the UFC, they've been bonkers, and I don't know if maybe changes in barometric or atmospheric pressure really affect Albert Duraev all that well, because in the first round that he had against Joaquin Buckley, one eye started to puff up, and then in the second round, the other eye started to puff up. And in his fight against Roman Kopylov, if you go back and watch that one, well, the same thing can be said. His eye puffed up really, really bad. Duraev has puffy eyes when they get hit.
You know who he's like. Kell Brook is the automatic person I think of. Gennady Golovkin broke his orbital, comes back 6 months later. You know what Errol Spence Jr. does? Breaks the same darn orbital, because that's the interesting thing. Like, the Diaz brothers, people talk about that a lot with scar tissue. Injuries do seem to be reoccurring, especially with the damage on people's faces. Like, this isn't baseball where you just have to worry about sliding the wrong way and you might roll your ankle. Injuries do seem to be reoccurring, and I am interested to see if that eye will continue to pop up against Joe Kuwani, who can really throw damaging strikes.
Well, and if you do look at it, it's the biggest clash of styles fight that you're going to find in this card, because for Albert Duraev, I don't know why he decided to just kickbox with Joaquin Buckley. I know they talked about it in the fight that they had both trained together before and there was a lot of bad blood going into it, but Duraev, even on his entries for the takedowns, he was able to have a little bit of success up against the cage, but Buckley was able to pop right back up. And if there's any negative about Buckley, yeah, there's big actions, but his takedown defense can suffer in certain fights. And for as good as Duraev is at locking those hands, dumping you down and chaining together his takedowns, it was a little bit of a surprise that that's where he wasn't able to find the success against a guy like Buckley. And Duraev's one of those weird cases where he was so good with ACB. Oh, he was 8-0. He's a double champ. Making the weight at welterweight was too tough, so then he was forced up to middleweight. He took a really long time off from 2018, the Piotr Struz win, to then taking on Kyo Bittencourt over on Contender Series. And Duraev was a minus 400 favorite against Bittencourt, roughly a minus 400 favorite against Kopylov, and a minus 225 favorite against Joaquin Buckley. So, giant favorite in a lot of these matchups. Obviously, he had wins over UFC-level talent outside of the UFC. He beat Clifford Starks with ACB. He also had a win in his third pro fight against Xavier Fupa, you know, fat upper pubic area. Pokam, who had two fights in the UFC, he beat him in his third pro fight. Xavier was already in the UFC to that point, so that was kind of crazy to see from Duraev. But you know the skills are there. He's going to throw a lot of big hooks to try and close the distance, to get his takedowns, and mount some heavy offensive ground and pound. We saw that in the Kopylov fight. You saw that when he was an ACB champ. For Chitty and Joe Kuwani, you talk about Bellator main events. You talk about the fights that he's had in the UFC. Okay, Chitty and Joe Kuwani, UFC debut, performance bonus. Second fight out, performance bonus. Last fight, fight of the night. And he went out there against Gregory Rodriguez, and on the first takedown attempt, landed that knee up the middle that cut Gregory in the center. And for the rest of the fight, up until Gregory finished it, Mark Smith's eyes were glued on Gregory's bone between his eyeballs.
Have you seen the new Doctor Strange movie?
No.
Well, that's how it ends. He gets like an eye. That's what it looked like. Like, Chitty and Joe Kuwani landed one of the more damaging non-knockout strikes you are ever going to see, and somehow lost the fight, which is very interesting. I do think you have to break it down, because there's some fighters we talk about to where, hey, when they fight tired, they're still pretty much the same fighter, right? You can tell that they might not be fighting at 100% peak capacity, but the strikes that they throw are still the same variety of strikes. They still incorporate the kick. And I think that's the most telling thing about a lot of fighters. Think about Dan Hooker. Dan Hooker is a very technical striker who has fought in main events, has good cardio, and can fight five rounds. Dan Hooker starts all of his fights kicking a lot, then kicks less, and then wrestles as the fights normally go on, because kicks do take a lot of energy to keep on throwing throughout your fights. The thing about Joe Kawani is, when he incorporates the kicks into his combinations, he is as dangerous as anybody from open space in the octagon.
Which could play out well in the first round against Duraev, exactly. Because the first big action that Buckley had was a full force head kick to Duraev, whose hand was down, and he ate it like it was
and
nothing.
There's definitely some parallels between Joaquin Buckley and Chidiun Joe Kawani. Now, frame-wise, they're not similar at all. That has to be said. Joe Kawani, kind of a thin guy, more upright with his style and his posture.
One of the longest reaches in the middleweight division.
But he blasts a lot more kicks, too. With Joaquin Buckley, he'll load up and throw kicks, but they're not as organically as his combinations. Whereas Joe Kawani will throw to left hand, not really even trying to throw anything on it, just to set up the kick behind it. And I agree with you. I think those kicks and those combinations are going to be not easy for him to land in the first round, but they will be definitely open earlier on in the fight. But this is one of those fights where I favor Joe Kawani almost like heavily as the fight begins. Like, I could see him going out there just starching Duraev quite quickly, but every second that ticks off this clock is like an hourglass, and Joe Kawani's at the top, Duraev's in the bottom. So I do worry about just the lasting power of Joe Kawani, because when he gets tired, now granted that normally happens after he throws a lot of potential fight ending strikes, and he probably would have knocked out anybody not named Gregory Rodriguez in that matchup. I just worry about if he's on the receiving end of some takedown attempts, if he's not able to get that distance and really let his hands go, what is he going to be able to do on the in-betweens? Because the in-betweens are probably going to win him this fight, and I just don't know if he has enough there.
And it really is tough, because Joe Kawani at the start, at the first round of that fight against Gregory Rodriguez, he showed really good takedown defense. And then in the second round, it was Rodriguez with kind of a hip toss and Joe Kawani on bottom. And then as Rodriguez softened him up with strikes, and Joe Kawani just kind of held on. And it looked like one of his legs was a little bit trapped there, but didn't really show much wherewithal to get out of the way. And for both these guys, to talk about the level of competition outside of the UFC, for Chidiun Joe Kawani at welterweight, I mean, I'm going down through it.
Brandon Thatch, one of the all-time greats.
Brandon Thatch, Jeremy Kimball, we've got Max Griffin as a win, Ricky Rainey, you've got Andrea Fialho, Melvin Gallard, Andre Koroshkov, Izaki Kato, you've got John Salter, the last, but that guy's a grappling ace over there, Jim O. Rafael Carvalho, the former longtime middleweight champ over with Bellator. So a lot of really good names on the record of Joe Kawani. And the biggest thing can be said for both of these guys. They both struggled to make welterweight. Duraev was forced up. Chidiun Joe Kawani, bad weight cuts made him sound like me before, to then sounding like Barry incredible. White, like he sounds right now. He's got one of the most sultry voices in MMA. But the joke aside, it was due to the weight cutting. That's what changed his voice quite a bit. So he's not quite like his brother Anthony, where it's all striking all the time, can't defend the takedowns. Chitty is better in some of those in-betweens. But against a guy like Duraev, you can see in Joe Kawani's kickboxing style, and a guy who trains out of Sykes and Janjira Muay Thai, struggle against a guy like Duraev in that respect. So I mentioned that Duraev in his last three fights was a giant favorite. He is the underdog in this matchup, so that might intrigue some people. We saw somebody like, Abubakar Nurmagomedov recently. Exactly. Giant favorite for pretty well all of his career. His last time out, he was due the underdog. But we look at this, and Joe Kawani's a favorite. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. People don't like puffed up eyes, so I'm going to say over under 70% of Joe Kawani.
I think they'll be over.
Think they're going to be over? They are over. 731 total votes, 85% of Joe Kawani, 90% by knockout. For the 15% that have Duraev, 49% by decision, and 28% by submission, who do you have in the matchup?
I have the underdog, actually, because I'm trying not to let recency bias get into my mind. And I know those were big shots that Joe Kawani landed against Rodriguez, but Gregory Rodriguez is a fighter who we talk about as grappling a lot. Do we see his grappling a lot in the UFC? Like, is it at the forefront of his game like it is his boxing, his power shots? Not necessarily. And I do worry about Duraev and his ability to eat those shots, especially early on in the fight. I cannot stress that red flag any more than I am right now. But I think you can get a little bit clouded with your judgment based on his last performance against Joaquin Buckley, who I actually think Joaquin Buckley's a decent fighter. Like, I know the peaks are high, the valleys are low, but in the middle there's a pretty decent fighter. So for those reasons, and I'm going to look stupid on Saturday when this fight's over, I have Albert Duraev in the matchup.
Give me Chitty Bang Bang and Joe Kawani. I mean, Albert Duraev cannot roll with the punches at all. Like, even in the fight that he had against Roman Kopylov, as it went on, Kopylov, I mean, his nose was melted like a stick of butter in the first round, but as it went on, he brought himself back into the fight. So I do like Chidiun Joe Kawani in the fight. We'll see if that adrenaline dump does play a factor in this one, because Duraev's the type of guy that can fight on somewhat of a line in these fights. So we're split on the pick. I'm going with Chidi
Bang Bang and Joe Kawani, Matt Cohen with Albert Duraev. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Vera taking on Sandhagen in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Another flyweight banger on the card in the OG Dana White's Contender Series High Flyer, the first fighter from the Contender Series to fight for a UFC title. It is Alex Perez, a switch of the gym in this camp, Matt. Going to be training at a Syndicate MMA as per his Instagram. He's taking on the former, you talk about a high flyer, he flew as high as you could fly with
like
Ryzen.
Like Evan Bourne in 2009.
Fly high.
I don't know where these WWE references are coming from.
But Matt, it is the star boy, Manel Kopp, guy representing Angola and Portugal. And if you look at it for Kopp, his first couple of fights, a little rocky in the UFC. He dropped the decision to Alessandro Pantoja, and then a chintzy, and I mean chintzy, decision to Mateus Nicolau, where 21 of 21 on MMA decision scored it for Kopp. But if you look at it for him in these last number of fights, three-fight win streak, finished Ode Osborne, finished August Shumagulov, and beat David Dvorak by decision, dropped him in the third round of that matchup, and his hands looked amazing. And if you want to see a great Manel Kopp fight, you can watch his fight with Asakura before he came into the UFC. But that fight that he had against Žalgiris Šumagulov, he was eating some of those shots, and a lot of people thought that he wouldn't. But Žalgiris, as we know, if you're top five, if you're bottom five, Žalgiris is going to give you a gritty fight. And for Manel, you look at that finishing sequence up against the cage.
Beautiful.
I don't know if I've seen faster hands mixing up the hooks and the uppercuts. Looked amazing in that one. His stance switches, his hooks from either side when it's at distance, his leg kicks, very, very good in these matchups. And the wrestling shoes definitely helped him out when he was over with Ryzen with his wrestling. And he's no slouch there. I mean, you've heard it from Daniel Cormier. Used to train at AKA in Thailand, the Mike Swick gym, but also AKA in the States. Spent quite a bit of time at Extreme Couture as well, has Manel Kopp. But in this matchup, Alex Perez is at a decided advantage. I mean, we're talking about West Hills College Lemoore All-American Alex Perez, a guy who's wrestling got him into MMA, brought him to the point where he was at, and he started off his UFC career 6-1 going into that fight against Deiveson Figueiredo, losing somewhat impressively.
I think Alex Perez is a really good fighter.
There you go. Like, that should be a controversial take to have, because you can't forget the fighter he was before that Figueiredo matchup. And honestly, I know he lost by submission in the first round, so there's not a lot of positives to take. You bring up the leg kicks for Kopp. Alex Perez has a decided advantage in the leg kicks in this matchup. Alex Perez throws leg kicks like he's Justin Gaethje. He really does. He is that, like, one percentile leg kicker to where it does make a difference in his fight. Look at his biggest win in his career. Poor Juicy A for me.
Y'all must have forgot. Juicy A at one point, he beat Deiveson Figueiredo before Figueiredo won the title.
Exactly. So I was gonna, you don't gonna steal my thunder, Craig. So for Perez, he looked great with his leg kicks on the outside, and I think that's going to really inhibit the movement of a guy like Manel Kopp, because we like that movement on the outside. We like his stance switches. Hard to switch stances if your legs are beat up. And I think a lot of people have lost sight of just how talented of a fighter Perez was before he has suffered these losses, because Pantoja, I'm here to tell you guys, he's beat Brandon Moreno twice. If they fought for a third time, there's a pretty darn good chance he beat him a third time, because styles make fights, and that's a difficult stylistic matchup. But that was the additional crack in the armor that we saw from Perez. You bring up the wrestling, it is good. The second Pantoja got on his back, though, it just went downhill
and
so fast.
That was the weird part about that fight. It was Perez that initiated the grappling in that
It was just a trip, though, where Pantoja got onto his back and, like, backpacked him basically immediately. It was just Perez didn't show a lot of escapability from that position, and I thought he would have a higher level of grappling from some of those defensive spots, because if you're a grappler like Perez, you're a good striker. We all know how good his striking is. He has good offensive wrestling. If you are going to work on anything, it would be nice to see a bit of a threat off the back or just the ability to get back up a little bit faster, because I don't know how much factor the wrestling is going to be in this matchup. And I'm curious, like, do you think either guy's going to go for a high volume of takedowns, or are they going to kind of cancel each other out?
Manel Kopp's good in both aspects of the wrestling, and so is Alex Perez. But to answer it, I think Perez would be the more likely to do it, because if you look at two of the fights that he had, not the same level of competition. Either guy's kicking around in the UFC and fighting all that often. But Mark De La Rosa, Eric Shelton, Perez was able to go out there with a high volume of takedowns, really wrangle up a lot of control time. And then en route to the title shot, he finished Jordan
Espinoza and Jussie Formiga, both bonuses, and then that got him into the conversation. The weird part about it is Pantoja beats Perez, and then Pantoja's an alternate not that long ago, UFC 283.
Give him the title shot.
Yeah, he had his run-ins after the fight there. And
you'd have to assume he's fighting Moreno, though.
Manel Kopp, UFC 256, he was supposed to make a debut, and then the fight got scratched at late notice. So Manel Kopp weighed in as the alternate, having not fought in the UFC for the title. So that's some crazy stuff right there. But if you do look at this matchup, Matt, and we go down through it, I mean, Kopp, his last time out against David Dvorak, the two times that Dvorak was able to kind of either get the takedown or wrangle him in to try and get a submission ability was off of a Kopp spin. One was off a kick, one was off a spinning elbow, and you could see Dvorak's eyes light right up. You could see him looking right at the target and grabbing the neck as Kopp was spinning for the elbow, which partially glanced. So if you do consider for both these guys, there's a lot of opportunities for Perez. You talk about Syndicate MMA being on the up and up. Joanne Wood won last weekend, so that's definitely a good win. Jordan Levitt picked up a giant win his last time out. So just a few of the fighters that are there. Vince Morales is somebody that I saw on the Instagram in training with Alex Perez. A guy who mixes martial arts very well, something that you want to see out of Perez to get back in that win column. Manel Kopp is more than a 2-1 favorite in the matchup. Tapology vote surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 90% Manel Kopp.
I think they'll be under.
Think they're going to be under? They're slightly under. 752 total votes. 85% Kopp, 68% by knockout, 15% that have Perez, 68% by decision. So who do you have in the matchup in this fight?
I think the Tapology votes are disrespectful, to be completely honest with you. I see this fight as being much more down the middle, just because... Not that Kopp hasn't looked good in his UFC tenure by any means. He's looked very good. It's just when he does fight these upper echelon guys, it's not like he's blowing them out of the water, like knocking them out 70% of the time. So I think this could be a difficult fight. But what I like about it is we're going to learn more about both guys, which is weird to say because there's a lot of tape on both of them. It's just always fun when you get flyweights fighting elite flyweights. And I think this is going to be an incredibly fun fight by the time it's all said and done. Hopefully I have given Alex Perez his flowers because I do think he could threaten with the wrestling. I really like the kicks too. I can't talk about them enough, but I do think Kopp is the more diverse striker on the back foot, and I do think the boxing is going to be a factor because Perez, for as good as his kicks are, the threat of the hands don't always come into play right after the kicks come out. He will threaten a lot more with the wrestling off of the kicks, so I think for the boxing, I favor Kopp, but I'm really splitting hairs here, guys. I see this as a very close fight.
And I see it for Manel Kopp. For Alex Perez, the last win was almost 3 years ago back in June of 2020 over Jussie Formiga, and if you look at it, I mean, there's definitely been a lot of changes. The other thing that kind of makes me concerned, and it's the same thing in the CJ Vergara fight against Daniel Da Silva. Both these guys have struggled making weight in the UFC, and Alex Perez, you look at that sheet over on Topology, all the fights that were canceled before he ended up taking one against Pantoja, losing them more booked and more canceled after that. So both of us going with Starboy, Manel Kopp, the boxing combinations are key, but the leg kicks for Perez, you gotta watch out, and that wrestling as well. Another big time fun fight at flyweight for sure, and a big time fun fight up weight class in the main event at bantamweight. You have Corey Sandhagen taking on the third ranked Marlon Vera. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The women's flyweight division coming up this weekend. Louisiana's Andrea Lee doesn't have to travel too far to take on the future Macy Barber. And when it comes to 2023, the future's in the UFC. Ian Gary won.
It's too many.
Sam Patterson lost. They're 1-1. Macy Barber looking to take it home and sweep it and go 2-1. And when it comes down to this fight, Matt, I don't often start videos out this way, but since we've done Fight Night Picks, since we picked fights, since UFC 247 as a sample size, you and I are both, I went back and watched them today, 0-5 in picking Andrea Lee fights. We picked Lee to beat Murphy, Lee to beat Modafferi, Shevchenko to beat Lee, Calvillo to beat Lee, and Lee to beat Araujo. We are terrible at picking Andrea Lee fights.
Don't worry, I'm going to take that baton and keep on running with it. This fight's going to be really one-sided one way or another. I'm just telling you right now, I'm either going to look like a genius or an idiot, so get ready to make the comments right now. Macy Barber either marches Andrea Lee down and makes her pay for it up against the cage over and over and over again, or Andrea Lee gets really close to the cage, really close, but has just enough distance to keep her back off of it and can maintain her movement. And if she could just jab and throw like a straight shot every now and then, think of the Montana De La Rosa fight. That's a great example. Montana De La Rosa, much more of a wrestling threat, I would say, than Macy Barber, but she's like 70-30 wrestling to striking, whereas Macy Barber's like 70-30 striking to wrestling, I guess. So I think there are some similarities, at least in the way that they approach the fight. But Barber's either going to march Andrea Lee down, get her up against the cage, use the clinch, and that's what I do think Barber's going to have to do in this fight. Lee is great at using that movement, using her back foot, and making you chase her in the fight so that she's not getting cut off in the octagon. But if Macy is able to really use that clinch, incorporate it, just to hold Lee up against the cage, I think it will open up some of those flurries after she immediately breaks out of the clinch. But as I say that, Andrea Lee's not some like slouch in the clinch. She is very good from that position, but if you go back and watch the Joanne, I think it was Calderwood at the time, now Wood, she was able to hurt Lee bad in the clinch on multiple occasions. And I know Wood's someone who that's kind of at the forefront of her game. We talked about the clinch elbows quite a bit, but I do think the aggressiveness of Barber is going to be able to get her in some of those similar situations to where she can have similar success, not with the elbows, of course, but with a lot more of those powerful hooks we've seen Macy use throughout her career.
When you break it down for both these women, Andrea Lee is somebody that's going to throw more volume, land more shots than Macy Barber does. Typically, she's also the more susceptible to getting takedowns in her fights as well, and you'll definitely remember the fight that Lee had against Antonina Shevchenko, where it was okay for me at that point in time in my life. I thought Shevchenko was gonna have success in the kickboxing, and Andrea Lee cut the distance, brought it down to the mat, and ended up getting the submission win. And for Lee, her last time out, this is where it gets really weird. I mean, whether it was 29-27s, whether it was 30-27, like however you scored that fight. First round, Viviane Araújo, hands drop just a little bit, steps in as Lee steps into her own jab. The jab drops Araújo, and Lee ends up on the bottom, and well, with Araújo on the mat, and Lee's hammering away. So for me, she won the first round, Araújo maybe the 10-8 in the second round, and then the third round was a 10-9 for Araújo. It was a little bit of a surprise for Lee in that matchup, and there were reasons why I thought, hey, cardio is going to carry her to a win, striking on the outside is going to be able to get her the win. It's just, I have a really hard time, you know, picking these fights. And then it clouds my judgment, and I go back and watch them, and I can pick up on these positives from Andrea Lee, who's somebody that kind of crouches to her opponent's stance because she is one of the bigger fighters at 125. She does keep her hands a little bit low, but those odd angle punches tend to find their home. And for Barber, it's pressure, 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 pressure. And we look at those two losses that she had. The loss against Roxanne Modafferi was definitely a tough one with the injury.
She Clay Thompson herself.
Then she took on Alexa Grasso, the now champ, lost the decision there in somewhat of a close fight. Beat Miranda Maverick by split decision in a fight that majority thought that Maverick had won.
I thought she won that one, to be honest.
You're on
That's fine. We can disagree with that, but I thought she won that fight.
But last year, beating Montana De La Rosa, 30-27s across the board, and Jessica I, where I came back in the second round, but Barber won the first, won the third. It's just, will the pressure Macy Barber get her to a victory? The 313,000 Instagram fans versus Lee's 167,000. A lot of weird comments on those posts when I went to look at them today. A lot of weird comments.
I don't look at the comments of people's Instagram posts for these videos. I think Macy Barber has a great chance to win this fight, but I worry about her getting discouraged by her own game plan, because she's going to have to eat punches to win this fight. It's not going to be a clean victory where, oh, Macy Barber walks in, knocks her out in the first round, and it's just all sunshine and flowers. Like, you're going to have to eat a lot of volume from Andrea Lee. You're going to have to be dedicated to the game plan, and that's why this is a really difficult fight to predict, because again, the power goes to Macy Barber and it's not really close in that one area, but Andrea Lee throws a lot at you. She does not allow you time to think, whether it's with the kicks or the punches, so it's a really interesting fight to see where Barber does fit into the division, because you bring up the losses. There's a pretty major injury to factor into one of them, and she lost to the champion, and there's no shame in that. So I think this is a really fun fight to figure out where Barber does fit into the division.
Barber, a bit of 2-1 favorite. Andrea Lee just turned 34 a few months ago. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Matt, surprised us there to you. I'm gonna say over under 80% Barber.
I think they'll be under.
I think they're gonna be under. They're slightly over. 749 total votes, 83% Barber, 86% by decision for the 17% that have Lee, 82% by decision. I think Macy Barber wins a decision with her pressure, but like you said, I mean, Andrea Lee gets mean in the clinch, throws elbows, throws knees, throws good punches on the outside and on the inside, can struggle moving the head when it's on the center line a little bit. Most people do, but for Andrea Lee, she can struggle in that respect. But again, I'm 0-5 picking Andrea Lee fights in the UFC. I'm throwing a dart at the veritable board, and if you make fun of me on this one, boys, have at her.
Have at her.
I mean, let's either go 1-5 or 0-6 together.
Yeah.
I've got Macy Barber in this one, too. I do like the forward pressure out of her, but again, I bring up the Montana De La Rosa fight a lot because as I was watching that fight, I'm like, oh my god. Well, Macy does everything Montana does. She just doesn't threaten as much with the wrestling. It's a lot more with the boxing combinations, but I think she'll be able to work herself into range a lot better than Montana did and avoid some of those punches. So I do have Macy Barber.
We'll see if the nickname, the future, can go 2-1 on the season. Both of us going with Macy Barber to get the win. Some big-time fights left on this card, including a bantamweight feature in the co-main event. Two former title challengers, one former champion, Yana Santos, taking on Holly Holm. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Not very often the fight gets booked about a week ago, and it ends up third on the main card. But coming up this weekend at featherweight, Nate the Train Landwehr doesn't know a boring fight, and he's going to be taking on a guy whose nickname suggests the same thing. In Lights Out Austin Lingo, Matt Lingo was due to be taking on Ricardo Hamosh a couple of weeks ago. It was on the Yon Duashvili card, and Ricardo Hamosh showed up thinking it was lightweight. Yeah. Weighed 154 for 145, and Austin Lingo doesn't get a fight. And for Nate Landwehr, he was due the 15th ranked contender in this division. And Alex Caceres is out. Big Marcel reports it on Twitter that this is the fight they throw together, and I love it.
I love it, but I hate it for Austin Lingo with this respect. The guy he was getting ready for doesn't fight a lot like the guy he is now getting ready for. And I know Hamosh is very talented. I'm not saying this to say he's not on the level, but that's a rangy striker who uses his jiu-jitsu, won't just walk forward and be the craziest man just to walk the face of the earth. So for Lingo, it is a little bit unfortunate that the camp probably won't carry over.
And we talked a lot about Austin Lingo in that fight against Ricardo Hamosh. And there's so many things to kind of draw from. Texan finisher, lights out. Austin Lingo has been on the shelf for some time. We haven't seen Lingo since 2021. He made it close to the top of the mountain with the LFA. He was putting on great performances. And out of all the finishes that Lingo has, five of them in the first round. In the UFC, he lost a decision to Yusuf Salal a few years ago. And he picked up big wins over Jacob Kilburn and Luis Saldana. Knockdowns in both of those fights. It was the first round against Kilburn. It was the third round against Saldana. And I love to see those gritty fights like Lingo was in against Saldana, where he gets outstruck in the first round. He grits his teeth. He wins the second round. Saldana slows down in the third round. And what drops Saldana in that third round? Switch levels, jab to the body, and Saldana's down. So a crazy performance from Lingo. I wish we got to see him in 2022. He had some injuries that he had to look after. He did an interview with, and I want to make sure that I get this one right. It was Low Kick MMA back in May of last year before his fight with David Onama. So he's supposed to fight in July. That the headline out of the interview was that was the last fight on his contract. So I would assume that this is the last fight on his contract, but I don't know for certain. So he said in the fight he was supposed to have against Jonathan Pierce that would have been February of last year, that he tore possibly his meniscus right before that fight. So he had it worked on by the doctor. He was going to be good to go for Onama, but of course that fight fell out. So as you'll remember, Austin Lingo was due David Onama that summer. And listen, Lingo's out, so Onama waits on the shelf for about a month and takes a fight against Nate Landwehr. Matt, we talked about it earlier on. Steven Peterson fought Julian Arosa, possible fight of the year. Nate Landwehr fought David Onama, possible fight of the year. And in the first round of that fight, Onama had Landwehr dead to rights.
He did.
And then Landwehr rallied himself back in. It was an all-time slobber knocker of a match if Jim Ross had kind of a thought on it. But you really do like that win that Landwehr has. And when he came into the UFC, he was kind of a boogeyman because he fought over with M1 Global. And Nate Landwehr isn't like a Shavkat Rachmanov from M1. But he's not necessarily like some of the other champs either. He's not an Alexander Volkov. He came in with a lot of fanfare, or some fanfare, fought Herbert Burns, and got knocked out in the first round of that fight. Then he fought Darren Elkins, and looked really good.
To be fair, though, I think it is okay to give ourselves some credit every now and then. We were saying what Nate Landwehr was before he came to the UFC. Like, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And for Nate Landwehr, if you watched him leading up to the UFC, you kind of knew what you were going to get. Like, he has not changed himself whatsoever.
When you have an American that's brought in to fight fighters overseas and lose, and then they keep winning and winning, and then the fighters keep getting more and more mad when they get beat, That embodies Nate Lynn, where Matt, I haven't done this in a little bit, but my record comp for this one, News of the World. You got this for me for Christmas a few years ago. People know Queen. People they like do. Queen. But I think the song that embodies Nate Lynn, we're on this, and it's not the first two, We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions. It's the song called, at the end of the first side, The Fight from the Inside. Fight from the Inside. And why would I say Fight from the Inside? Because this guy, I think his organs are made of, like, metal gears, and he just grits down, bites down on the mouthpiece, and he makes it tough. Like, his fight against Ludwig Klein, he's a pretty big underdog in that one. He goes out there, shows out, gets a submission win, and I know Klein's fight last weekend, it was, what, a draw against Jai Herbert? Herbert's a pretty darn good fighter. Landwehr getting the finish in that one, showing us the blood and guts in his last fight against David Onama. Obviously, people are going to rate him very highly off of those fights, and you're going to somewhat underrate Austin Lingo because it's been such a time that he's been away. But Lingo, he gets to sleep in his own bed. He's out of Dallas. He's going to be fighting in San Antonio, the Alamo City.
It's not always a great thing to be sleeping in your own bed, though. Derek Lewis has proved that.
That's true. But
it does happen quite a bit.
The wins that he has, you talk about a guy biting down in the mouthpiece, that Luis Saldana first round, and then for him to come back, drop some of that jab in the third round. A lot of big positives to draw from both these guys. So, Landwehr is the favorite in the matchup by quite a significant margin. We have a look at the topology votes. Surprise to us there, to you. I will say over-under in the matchup, 72.5% Nate Landwehr.
I think it'll be over.
I think they're going to be over, and they are significantly over. So only 490 votes, 90% Landwehr, 71% by decision. For the 11% that have Lingo, 66% by decision. And Austin Lingo is going to take on a whirling dervish, the Tasmanian Devil.
Was.
Ricardo Hamosh, a couple of weeks ago, Hamosh missed the weight and flew back to Brazil. Sad. So in this matchup, Matt, Lingo, he walks guys down, implements his boxing combinations, throws good kicks. His wrestling's not a negative by any means. He had that great win over Yusuf Salal that was able to show us some of those talents. In a matchup like this, I do like Nate Landwehr ever so slightly, but when you get a couple of guys that are fighting the nights waiting to happen, it's always hard to try and make a really like rock solid prediction.
I brought this up talking about Nate Landwehr before. I'm going to get oddly personal, but in like a fun way. There was a point guard for this guy, for this team in Heartland. He would run. And if you play basketball and you play against another point guard who would run, you know how much it sucks. Because, like, I shoot, right? I want to come off a screen, get wide open, take a three, and if I miss it, I can get back on defense easy. This guy would be really sweaty, get all over you, just be gross, and he'd run. Nate Landwehr is that guy. Now, to be fair, this guy busts my ass every time I ever played against him. He destroyed me because his style was like that. Nate Landwehr reminds me of this kid every time I see him fight just because he is a bit of a tryhard, but I mean that in the best way positive. Like, I know people say tryhard and they roll their eyes, but Nate Landwehr is not the type of guy who's going to give up on himself in a fight. Will he fight himself into bad positions sometimes? Yes, he will. Don't get me wrong, because that over-aggressiveness will get him caught. We've seen it happen many times before. If Herbert Burns can knock you out, then Austin Lingo can definitely have levels of success too, and doing it off the same things, off the aggressiveness of Landwehr. But I think Landwehr has learned a little bit off that performance. He's doing a better job at not getting his head in like the waist area of his opponents. He gets into the chest more is what I've noticed, which does help him avoid some of the knees up the middle. Now, he still eats punches that are straight like there is no tomorrow, but I do like the small changes I've seen of Nate Landwehr.
To make the Canadian connection, some people don't like this, but it's like a B-dub-dubs fact if you want to share it with your friends. You look at Nate Landwehr, his overall career arc, he was supposed to fight Gavin Tucker pre-UFC in Nova Scotia twice, and the fights did not materialize. Wow. Could you imagine? It would have blown the roof off of the Metro Center. Now it's the Scotiabank Arena. Matt, a big-time matchup coming up this weekend. Both of us going with the train. Nate Landwehr to bring the win back to Florida by way of Clarksville, Tennessee. It's a big-time fight on this card. Holmes Santos next. Main event, Vera taking on Sandhagen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. In the history of the UFC women's featherweight division, Matt, there's been three champions, there's been seven fights, and three of those seven fights have included these two women. Coming up this weekend, an all-timer in boxing and MMA, we have the 2022 International Boxing Hall of Fame inductee, the preacher's daughter, Holly Holm. She was able to continue with that O on the loss column, beating Ronda Rousey, winning the title, and then soon after getting finished by Miesha Tate. But if you look at it for Holly Holm, it's been an amazing career in the UFC. So many main events, co-main event slots. The only fight that wasn't a main or a co-main or a big-time pay-per-view fight was her fight against Marion Renault that got her the title shot. For Holly Holm, it's been nothing but roses, even with the losses in that column. And she's taking on Foxy Yana Santos. And I probably shouldn't say that because for Yana Santos,
Tiago might be mad.
This is the first fight for Yana going with the Santos last name. She was engaged to Tiago Santos. They had a kid together. And now it's no longer Kunitskaya. I'd be dead naming. It's Yana Santos.
Good for them.
For Yana, she's coming in after about a year and a half layoff, a little bit more than that. She took on Irene Aldana. She got dropped up against the cage, and you talk about busted on the mat. Her nose was disgusting. And Jason Herzog might have been an early stoppage, but not really. Saving a fighter from themselves. She was leaking quite heavily. After that, had the kid. Now she's back. So for Santos, trains out of American Top Team with Tiago, who's going to be making that PFL turn against Rob Wilkinson. I know we talked about it a lot.
I come after you after you saying think, Foxy like
you
that.
You think I'm excited about that fight? I've talked about it for like 3 weeks now. But for Yana, a good opportunity to right the ship. And this is a top 10 ranked fight, and it holds a lot of implications for a couple of fighters who haven't fought all that often very often. And when you look at it, for Holly Holm, her last time out, a main event against Ketlin Vieira about this time last year, she controlled the judo specialist and didn't let Vieira have those successes in the judo. And if you do have a look at it, majority of the people out there, MMA decisions, two scored at 48-47 Vieira. You had 16 scoring at 48-47 for Holm, and two had at 49-46 for Holm. I myself had at 48-47 for Holly Holm. If you look at it for both these women, again, you can play MMA math. I mean, Aldana finished Santos, and Holm beat Aldana. And in the opposite way, Santos beat Vieira, and Vieira beat Holm.
You know what never crossed my mind once when we were thinking of the fight of the nights? Holly Holm versus Yana Santos. Because Holly Holm, for the great highlights, I guess, throughout her game, and she does have great highlights. The 1-2 and the head kick is phenomenal. We know the kicks off the combinations. She has become a lot more of a clinch fighter at this stage of her career, and I know that's a weird thing to say, but it always was a part of her game. You kind of have to go back to pre-Ronda Rousey, but if you watch the Mary Renault fight, and I think it was Raquel Pennington the first time around, yeah, she does use the clinch quite a bit. Like, Holly Holm is jacked. I cannot stress this enough. She is as strong as any woman who has ever gone into the UFC, and she knows how to use that physical strength to her advantage. You might look at 41 and think, oh, she might be slowing down, but when you're way stronger than everybody and now you're 41, it might even the playing field a little bit, but
you're talking about the preacher's daughter, Matt. Oh,
is the preacher 98? How old's the preacher if his daughter's 41?
Just out there at one of those old-timey churches. I'm getting fired up because
everybody talks about Holly Holm and the multiple-time world kickboxing titles and all this stuff. It's great and all, but when you don't really fight like that at this stage of your career, it's not really worth bringing up. Like, I can talk about her boxing. She does have good boxing, but I don't think she's going to go out there and really try to hammer in one and twos with Santos. I really do think, and it might be weird to say this because you might favor Santos in a lot of the grappling exchanges in this fight. I think we're going to see a very similar fight to that Raquel Pennington one the second time around. A lot of Raquel, oddly enough, having success on the outside, kind of throwing the jab out there, making Holly uncomfortable. In the second she did anything that made Holly uncomfortable, Holly Holm would dig two underhooks and rush her to the cage and hold her there. And it wasn't the most aesthetically pleasing fight, but it won her the rounds, and it did win or the fight. And you bring up the MMA decisions. Like, a lot of people had that fight pretty close. Like, one way or the other, close for Holm or Vieira. Holm had a lot of her success, and you bring this up, against a primary grappler with the clinch in that fight. So I do think we are going to see a lot more of it against Santos. I don't know if we're going to see that Holly Holm from the Ronda Rousey fight that was, what, 9 years ago now, who would go out there and throw a lot more boxing combinations and mix it in with the head kick. And the thing about Rousey was the tailor-made opponent. She rushes in, she throws a lot of hooks, she doesn't use her range, which is the one thing that makes Holly very unique. So I think there is a pathway for Yana to win if she can get a trip off some of the clinches, but I see her being stuck in that position quite a bit.
Holm started her UFC tenure off Pennington, then Renault, then the win over Ronda Rousey. Since then, she's 4-6 and 0-3 in the subsequent title fights. She fought Jermaine Durandamy in a pay-per-view that not a lot of people watched and not a lot of people remember fondly.
She looked okay in the Cyborg fight. I can say that even though I was harsh on her.
She fought Chris Cyborg to a close enough decision, and then she got finished by Amanda Nunes in their fight for the Bantamweight title. And out of it, in total, 5 title fights in the UFC, including the loss to Miesha Tate as well. Again, 7 co-mains or main event slots as well. So if you do look at it, for her, a rise into the UFC, undefeated, legacy champion, and then she had the wins and the Rousey fight. And then if you look at it for Yana Santos, Yana fought 6-5 Raquel Canodo over with Invicta, and then she fought Chris Cyborg in the main event of UFC 222. for the title. I don't know why I said 2-2-2, like it's de-de-de, like I'm speaking French. But when you look at it for Yana, she was the first person to take Chris Cyborg down in a really long time. That was good. And then she got finished in the first round. And for Yana in the UFC, 4-5, we look at some of the wins in the 5-on in. A win over Marion Renault, so they both have that in common. The loss to Aspen Ladd, where she got finished. She beat Yulia Stoyarenko in one of the weirdest fights you're ever going to see, where Yulia, like a spider monkey, trying to jump up to pull her down up against the cage. And Yana just clinches and holds her and lands some decent shots. The fight against Ketlin Vieta, where Vieta tries to initiate the grappling with no striking, whereas... See, I almost did it. Kunitskaya lands some strikes, but not a lot. And then the fight against Irene Aldana, where Aldana's having success from the outside. This is a one-round fight. Yana does what she does in a lot of her fights, where she reaches for the clinch, like, way out, head right there. She gets hit. She gets the clinch, but then she's punished by Aldana, who then drops Yana and then ends up getting the finish once it hits the mat. So for both of these women, they can have success at their desired ranges. It's just going to be telling of who's got the speed advantage in a fight like this to me.
I think we're going to see a lot of pitter-patter from Holly Holm on the outside, and then a lot of immediately rushing in. I don't think we're going to see a lot of that middle range in this fight. That's the one thing. And that's the range where I think Santos can have success. So, you hate to say this for a co-main event, but you got to tell the fans the truth when you want to tell them the truth. I don't know if this is going to be the most aesthetically pleasing fight.
It's the kickboxing boxing out of Holly Holm. It's the black belt in Taekwondo for Yana Santos. Somebody who at one point, after she had her first child, considered and did retire from MMA for a few years.
The wild thing is, Eddie Hearn's talked about getting Katie Taylor to box Holly Holm. Like, Holly Holm has been in talks to do other things than be a UFC fighter. Now, I'm not saying that's taken all of her focus or anything like that. Those fights didn't come to fruition, but it is interesting that Holly Holm has kind of reached that stage of her career to where it is okay to kind of look outside of the UFC for that kind of stuff.
Fight Cecilia Brakos. Everybody wanted that for Chris Cyborg.
50 now, though.
See what happens. Matt, we have a look at the odds. Holly Holm is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 82.5% Holm.
I'm going to say over, but I don't feel good about it.
And it is over. So 779 total votes, 86% home, 88% by decision for the 14% that of Santos, 78% by decision. Matt, Holly Holm's last decision win in a 3-round fight was against the gym teacher, Marion Renault.
I will say this, and I'm not saying this to make a joke. Like, training with Thiago Santos is going to make you better. Like, he's super strong, is incredibly technical in most areas of his game, has good jiu-jitsu. Like, that is a real thing. I don't know if it's going to make her throw spinning wheel kicks.
I think training with all the other women at American Top.
No, you're right. I just, like, I don't think Santos is making her worse by any means. But I do have home in this fight. I brought it up many times. I don't know if she's going to be able to complete the takedown. And it is odd. When you go back and watch that Ronda Rousey fight, the most surprising part of the whole fight isn't the knockout. Holly Holm gets double underhooks, picks her up, and drops her down. Now, granted, she gets up immediately, but it was wild to see Holly Holm secure a takedown on a fighter like Rousey. Now, I don't think she's going to secure the takedown. I don't even think she's going to try to activate it off of the clinch, but I think the clinch is going to be good enough to at least secure rounds for Holm.
I think, like Eminem, round the outside from Holly Holm, round the outside. And Holly Holm to get the decision win in the matchup. Matt, a big-time fight in this one between Yana Santos and Holly Holm in the main event. Marlon Chito Vera taking on Corey Sandhagen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Big time banger of a main event at Bantamweight 2 weeks after Jan Dwalishvili. A big time shakeup at the top of this division. We have the number 3rd ranked man himself, Chito Marlon Vera, taking on number 5, Corey Sandhagen. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. Craig Allen, FNP, Twitter and Instagram. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen, FNP. And it's a big time fight in this division because for both these guys, they're coming off of wild 4th round finishes in main events, of course. For Corey Sandhagen, he beat Song Yadong, which if you're playing MMA math at home, Song Yadong beat Marlon Vera. So that is, listen, it's an eventuality.
That was a really good fight,
it's an
too.
Inevitability. It was a fight of the night when Marlon Vera fought Song Yadong, and a really close one as well. But for Corey Sandhagen, he opened up that cut earlier on in the fight, and it just continued to leak. The eyebrow was a mess, and at the end of the 4th round, they said that is enough. Corey Sandhagen, your victor. A picture of consistency in a lot of these fights. And for me, I went back, did a lot of tape study on this one, tried to find former common opponents. So that one for Sandhagen, a great win there against Song Yadong. For Marlon Vera, Four wins in a row. Bonuses, they are aplenty.
This Marlon girl Vera, is on fire.
Marlon Vera was 21 years old when he made his UFC debut at UFC 180 off the Ultimate Fighter Latin America that produced such names as the now interim featherweight champ, Yair Rodriguez. But Marlon Vera at the start, it was a little bit rocky. But I mean, since
he
then...
He was pretty good, though. No, I can say this. I've been on this Marlon Vera, like, hype train for a while. I knew he was good ever since he knocked out Brad Pickett. And I know, oh, he knocked out Brad Pickett. Of course, you hop on the hype train after that. That was a long time ago. Look at the bottom of his record, please. That
yeah, I'm just saying, Matt, he's 14-6 in the UFC. He's 10-2 in his last 12
but
fights.
But the skills were always there. You just have to look at the opponents that he struggled with. And they all fight in the exact same way. They're compact boxers who have more power than he does. All of them are pretty much. Song Yadong has more speed. Might not have the power of a Marlon Vera, but still. Gets on the inside, uses his speed. Jose Aldo gets on the inside, uses his speed in boxing. John Lineker, same thing. Douglas Da Silva de Andrade does the same thing. All of his opponents that he struggles with fight in a very similar manner. So I don't think Marlon Vera has made this massive change to his career. I think the one thing he has done is figured out, hey, I can't get off to these incredibly slow starts like I used to, because that's what Marlon Vera was known for. I know Brian Ortega kind of became known as the king of the comeback with those wild submissions, but Marlon Vera was well known for burning the first two rounds, which is a dangerous thing to do in the UFC, and then coming back and securing these incredible finishes. Even go back and watch the Brad Pickett fight. Brad Pickett beat him in round one and round two. He was just able to come back and land that wild head kick by the third round, which won him the fight.
And for the man in the hat of a British top team, that was a retirement fight right there. So a really tough one for Brad Pickett. Now, Matt, when you look at it for Marlon Vera, and you touched on it, to me, he's been able to heat up. The level of competition when he went on the first win streak isn't what it is right now. Willie G. Buren, Guido Canetti, Frankie Sines, Nolan Hernandez, and Andre Yule. Before he has the fight in the night against Song Yadong, that was at the ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena, one of the first cards back in 2020. Loses that one. First round, he burns. Second round, he looks great. Third round was really close. Then he takes on Sean O'Malley. Elbows from the guard, finishing up with the leg kicks. The peroneal nerve, if that was what he was able to hurt. The fight against Jose Aldo, we've got that iron-on patch of a tattoo for Jose Aldo, where Aldo was able to mix in the parts of his games. I know he's not credited with takedowns, but he had a lot of success with just his overall MMA game, did Jose Aldo. But the aggressiveness that we've definitely seen out of Marlon Vera these last four fights, Davey Grant, that was a fight of the night, the fight against Frankie Edgar, Rob Font, where it's round 2, 3, and 4 that Vera's able to go out there and drop him.
He made him look like a different person.
He made him puffy. He made him puffy in that one. And the epitome of that fight that he had against Rob Font that translates well into this one is, look at just the numbers. Rob Font completely outlands Marlon Vera in that fight. Who landed the harder shots that meant more out of the damage and the pressure in that one? It was Marlon Vera.
And that's the thing. If you go back and watch Song Yadong fight against Corey Sandhagen, Song gets on the inside a lot and, like, hits him with huge boxing combinations. I know Corey wins that fight. That's an incredible fight. I had such a fun time watching that fight again because Song made a great account of himself even though he got cut. The thing is, Corey Sandhagen was, let's say they were kind of even on the feet because Song was able to land big shots in the feet, was able to wobble, I would say, Sandhagen. There's one point in the round where he is able to hit him with a straight shot, sends Sandhagen back. The difference is, Vera's going to be able to threaten a lot more off the mat than Song Yadong was able to. He might not be the wrestler that Song Yadong is, because Song does have great defensive wrestling training with those guys at American, or at Team Alpha Male, sorry, but Marlon can threaten a lot more. The difference is, Marlon hits so hard. It is incredible. He's not someone who's built like a Francis Ngannou. He doesn't look like he's this one-hitter quitter, but he is the definition of it. If he gets on the inside and hits you with those clean hooks, he puts you down. And we saw that in the Dominic Cruz fight. Dominic Cruz was starting to gas up, starting to look like himself, laying those great combinations on the outside, those great angles. Marlon would cancel out the 4 great minutes of Dominic Cruz by landing those devastating hooks on the inside. And the good thing about Vera is, doesn't just have power in the right hand, doesn't just have power in the left hand. He is a four-limb striker, and he has power in all four limbs, has power in both legs and both hands.
Yeah, and if you gave Marlon Vera a chance to do, like, Lethwei, he'd probably be pretty darn good at that
probably
one.
But
be. The Song Yadong fight, I made the mistake. The first round was Song, the second round was Song, the third round was Vera, but the first round was very close. If you go and look at it in the fight against Rob Font, how did he knock him down? First hit was a left hook. Second knockdown was with a knee. The last one was with a head kick. And against Dominic Cruz, he had that weird short left hand in close. Then the next one was a jab that dropped him. And then, of course, the finale, that head kick that just completely hit him like a sack of potatoes.
But the thing is, these guys both are normally the rangier strikers in their matchup. I know Vera's not massive for the division, but he uses his legs and his reach about as well as anybody. So it is fair to say they're two of the rangier guys, but neither one's really going to have that advantage in this fight. And oddly enough, for two guys guys who do give up defense in terms of just adding more offense to their game, I think defense is going to be really important in this fight. And this is a part of Marlon's game that might help him, it might not. I don't honestly know the answer to this. We did see Sandhagen slow down a little bit against Piotr Jan in that fifth round. Piotr really came on strong by the fifth round. Not saying Vera is the fighter Piotr Jan is, they are different, but if Vera does kind of give up the first round and is sound enough defensively, letting Corey Sandhagen throw a lot of volume, I could see a world, and that's a dangerous, dangerous game plan against Corey Sandhagen, but you could see a world where Sandhagen is throwing a lot of that volume, throwing a lot of his combinations, but not landing with a lot of power, and I could see a world where Vera is able to, minute by minute, just get closer and closer to Sandhagen, because for as good of a striker as Corey Sandhagen is, he doesn't have that best one-hit knockout power. He's going to throw a lot of accumulations. He's going to damage you, like you said, with that elbow against Song Yadong. It's going to be combinations, straights, elbows, those weird angle shots, so I think this is going to be an easy fight of the night. Like, I am so excited for this fight.
Corey Sandhagen, there's a lot of movement. There's a lot of movement out of both guys. Both guys switch stances tremendously. I'd say Sandhagen might be a little more fluid into it because he continues to throw volume when he does it, but their volume numbers are insane. Sandhagen is 7th right now in bantamweight history with 5.93 significant strikes landed per minute. Sean O'Malley, obviously number one. But for Vera, where does he find himself in the bantamweight ranks? Number one all-time in bantamweight history with finishes being 10. He's got so many submission wins. For Corey Sandhagen, his MMA math line that grows stronger, he beat John Lineker. But Marlon Vera lost to John Lineker. And in that Lineker
I'm
fight...
I'm telling you though, that fight went 10 seconds longer.
Lineker was ranked 8th in that one. Corey Sandhagen was unranked. And Lineker, what did he do? He threw hands of stone. Everything he threw was hooks with 100% power in it. And Sandhagen did a good job of rolling with a lot of the shots in it. Game. And then in the third round, he struggled with it. But for me in this fight with Sandhagen, the one thing that weirds me out with Marlon Vera is he tends to shell up a lot. But the best part of his defensive shell, when he rolls with the punches himself, his elbows are tucked low enough to where he covers enough of the body that guys don't tend to hit him in the body a lot. Corey Sandhagen is one of those guys that after he's pop, pop, pitter, patter, getting you, you know, kind of thinking of moving up top, then he goes left hook to the body and he starts to throw a lot of his kicks in his combinations. And that's where Sandhagen could pull away, or it opens up a lot of the power shots of Marlon Vera to counter off of that.
You're right. I think Sandhagen's going to have a big advantage if he's moving forward, because you're right about Marlon does a good job blocking the body. Corey Sandhagen will grab your wrist, frame off with it, and use his elbow over the top. Like, that's one of his favorite techniques. If you do just rely on kind of a... Not that Vera doesn't have an active defense, because he does have an active defense. He keeps his hands up, he moves his head behind it. But if he does find himself not moving his feet and becoming a little bit more stationary on the back foot, I could see Corey Sandhagen really picking up steam and starting to land his own combinations, because I think Marlon has more power. I think that's fair to say. But Corey throws a higher variety of shots. He throws spinning elbows. He will incorporate the elbow a lot more. He really is kind of the Sultan of Swing when you think about it, because he mixes it in with the movement, with the spins.
Corey Sandhagen, Babe Ruth.
There you go. Big Dire Straits fan? Maybe. Probably before his time. Anyways, I think this is one of those fights, though, where the prediction's not wrong no matter what. Either guy could win by knockout round 1 through 5. I think that's fair. Another guy could win by decision in a 5-round fight, which you can't often say that, because normally you favor one guy a lot with the cardio, and I don't right now.
You touch on the aspect of Corey Sandhagen and his creativity. For Marlon Vera, watch the third round that Piotr Jan had against Sandhagen. What was it that really rocked Sandhagen and sent him to the canvas? Spinning back fist into a left hook.
And so nice.
So Marlon Vera can get creative that way. And we touched on it earlier. Marlon Vera, when he took on Sean O'Malley, story of the fight was the leg kicks, but he beat the leg kick champ and Andre Ewell. Marlon Vera's leg kicks are very good.
When he turned it on in that fight, he looked incredible.
They're an underrated part of his game for sure. So both of these guys, just two of the better strikers that you're going to find in this division that is one of the premier divisions in the UFC. I know lightweight gets the shine. I know Conor McGregor's mean mugging with Dana White in the background with Michael Chandler today, but we threw it on over to you guys in the community tab. YouTube community tab, about 1,000 votes here. 55% going with Chito Marlon Vera. In the comments section, Russ Gaudette, I think Marlon is going to be too stationary, and Corey's going to light him up with some dynamic stuff. Gibiscus is saying, I'm all over Corey in this matchup. We also have Randy saying, Randy Bobandy. I mean, Dirty Blue Jay Burger saying, 5 rounds, I'm going Chito. Although stylistically, this is a tough one for him. Crafting is saying, this is going to look like Chito versus Font, but maybe less damage on Corey. And I think that's a really smart one there. And we'll go with Joe Richardson as well, saying Chito wins this. So the fans are really close on this one. And this is similar to last weekend's matchup. It was about a 55-45 split that had Usman over Edwards, Edwards getting the win in the trilogy matchup. So in this one, Matt, it really is a tough one to try and pick. Corey Sandhagen versus Marlon Vera, a great main event in this one.
It's an incredible fight. Like, this is going to make you an MMA fan if you've never watched MMA before. Watch Sandhagen Vera. You're going to be incredibly entertained by the end of it. I have Corey Sandhagen by the straw that broke that camel's back that one time. Like, it is that close of a fight to where it's so dangerous for him to do the one thing he's really good at. Get on the inside, throw elbows, and be dynamic. Easier said than done when there's a guy who, again, has power from both sides, throws an incredible amount of strikes. And the thing about Marlon that he's really good at, and it makes me worry because I'm picking Sandhagen, Sandhagen moves like Dominic Cruz, but he's a lot more offensively oriented. Marlon Vera figured out the movement of Dominic Cruz, baited him into a kick, and then just met the head with the foot and was able to knock him out that way. So I think Vera doesn't get the credit he deserves for not just being a tough fighter. He's a smart fighter too, but I do have Corey Sandhagen by a minuscule amount.
I ever so slightly like Sandhagen the matchup as well because of his offensive output. His output, he lands about 2 strikes per minute more than Marlon Vera does. Vera absorbs more strikes per minute than he throws. But he's also, 12-4 in the UFC? So, 12-6?
Like, when he kicks pads on video...
14-6.
It's terrifying. I couldn't imagine
how hard... Is it as bad as Joe Rogan when he kicks pads on video?
It sounds like a thunderstorm.
The bash!
But Marlon Vera is, we used to joke about how, Gabriel Benitez, they say it, a.k.a. pound for pound, he has the hardest kicks. Like, Marlon Vera legitimately probably has pound for pound some of the harder kicks in the UFC, which is wild. But Sandhagen and Vera is going to make for one of the best fights of the year. I can almost guarantee you that much.
Matt, it is an amazing main event. A lot of really intriguing prospects on this card. If you're not already looking forward to it right yet, make sure you check out the Nate Landwehr fight that's against Austin Lingo. That should be an amazing one. I know Steven Peterson, Lucas Alexander.
It's a good one.
We're excited about that one. And Manuel Torres taking on Trey Ogden. A couple of clashes of styles. Manuel Torres, you talk about a guy that burns white hot. Manuel Torres is red, orange, white, and blue out of that fire. He gets it all done, and he's taking on the big fundamental in Trey Ogden. San Antonio special there with the Tim Duncan
Will Tim Duncan be in attendance? I think the odds would be minus a million. No.
Yeah. Nah. He's out braiding his hair. But probably. Matt, a big time fight card coming up this weekend from the Alamo City. We thank you so much for tuning in. The subscriptions and the likes, they are much appreciated. We're live 2 hours before the prelims coming up this Saturday for Fight Night Picks ? If any fights fall out, if they're added, moved, subtracted, whatever, we will be here on YouTube. So make sure you stay tuned for all of that content here on the channel. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it.